You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Today on Flashpoints, we devote the entire hour to the highly flawed rollout of the legal cannabis industry in California. We'll speak to Hezekiah Allen, Executive Director, Cannabis Growers Association, Chris Conrad, expert on people's rights to medicinal cannabis, Omar Figueroa, author and lawyer on cannabis law regulations, and Sarah Schrader. She's with Sonoma County Americans for Safe Access, and also joining the discussion is Lourdes Mota. Lourdes Mota, a longtime cannabis farmer and owner, manager, Stagecoast Farm and Products. And I'm Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavilan Molina. We are definitely flying by the seat of our pants, but we're here. It's KPFA. It's your daily investigative news magazine. We want to thank all of you for coming in and speaking with us today on Flashpoints. It's a good time to reevaluate the rollout of this huge industry that really is changing the history of California in many ways. So it's good to have you all with us. And I'd like to begin by just sort of getting an overview from each of you based on your perspectives, what you're thinking in the context of the rollout. And let me start with you, Hezekiah Allen, Executive Director, Cannabis Growers Association. From my perspective, and I've gone to many medicinal clinics now. I've talked to many people standing behind the counter. I have a good idea of what's happening, but we'd love to hear it from an expert.
Sure. First and foremost, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. It's great to have this type of program to dig into these tough questions and you know, help make progress. So, you know, I'm just going to be direct. It's a bit more negative than I hoped to be 8 months in, but in my opinion, we're seeing really the worst case scenario. We're seeing a regulated market that doesn't have product choices, that, you know, is overpriced compared to the unregulated market. And on the flip side, we're seeing an unregulated market that is occupied by really, you know, hundreds of high quality, well priced brands that people know and trust. And unfortunately, all of the people making those products desperately want a license. And for one reason or another, they can't get into the regulated market. So, you know, this is sort of the storm that we've been warning of for the last few years. California moves slow bureaucratically, and there's a bit of a mismatch here. Too much too fast has left most people out of legalization.
Talk about the multiple pitfalls in that context.
Sure. You know, we've really identified, our membership is about 1,600 businesses statewide. Unfortunately, the largest membership category is non-operational at this point. So we're able to talk with them, and we've identified about 45 specific barriers to entry. We've organized them into policy barriers, economic barriers, and cultural barriers. Moving backwards, you know, cultural barriers, some people can't or don't want to conform with things like building code or permits, or maybe they're outlaws by design. That's a very small segment of the population. A lot of folks can't afford it. Without access to bank loans, you know, typical small business development loans, one-time regulatory costs are really staggering to a lot of folks. And finally, the policy barriers. Most of the state has not started issuing permits. Those local permits that you need in order to get a state license, most of the state isn't issuing those yet. So in actual terms, most of the state of California is still living under a de facto prohibition.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is a special. We're devoting the hour to the massive rollout as of January 1st of the legalization of marijuana, both for medicinal causes and as well as for recreational use. And we've got some people in the studio who know a great deal, who've been in this for a very long time. This is a huge deal in California and in other states as well. We're going to focus on California today, because really, where goes California goes the rest of us on this one. And well, let me turn to you, Lourdes, because you're at the, you know, you're coming at the exact other side, coming from the exact other side. You're in the business. Explain, first of all, just say something about your business. Tell us about what you've been up to.
Absolutely. First, thank you, Hezekiah, for outlining that. You were so on point.
And lean right into that, Mike.
Yes, absolutely. And I want to say that, first of all, we are a very small, family-run Stagecoach Ranch, growers of high-quality flowers. We have an incredible following. We enjoyed the farm-to-table process, getting out there, speaking to what our former patients and are now customers about all the love that we put into our plants and how they were tested. And we would even welcome folks to come out and have a look at our garden. And that is gone. We are forbidden. We are trying to succeed in this permit process. It's not only the permit. It's also landowners are gouging us because their properties are now in this golden zoned, this green zone area where big corporations can come in and pay up to $4 a square foot for their property. How are we ever supposed to make it with thousands of dollars? You cannot even get through the permit process without an attorney. You can't even get through the permit process without an architect to help you to understand this legal, pardon me, mumbo jumbo that we have to do. We're lay people. We're gardeners. We're farmers. We are people that are ethical and we believe in our products. And now all of a sudden we have to comply with these incredible rules where it takes a scientist to even make their way through it. But besides that, it's just the frustration of once you are able to achieve this permit, then you need to go through a distributor, which makes it impossible to ever show your face at an event, talk to people. All of the events that we loved attending, the Emerald Cup and the shows all over, that's gone. So that's pretty much my big question of, is there light at the end of the tunnel? Are we going to be able to look into people's eyes and talk about the quality of our product, have them sample it, and what's the future going to hold for us?
And what about the packaging requirements?
Oh.
Because it is amazing how this industry got Americanized. You know, I remember Coca-Cola is not a soda company. It's a bottling company, right? They're not telling you what's inside. We thought these were important products that, you know, if you're serious, medicinally speaking, you know, this is about life, about, you know, all the farmers I spoke with in this field saying how they wanted to bring a different kind of agriculture, let this industry set an example. And here we are. Talk about packaging, because I can't even, you know, first of all, I couldn't even afford it. I can't even afford this stuff anymore. And if I could and I managed to get my hands on it, I wouldn't be able to get inside because it's impossible.
Well,
you can't break the packages.
Seriously. I know. It's incredible. And you have touched on another area, another point it's baffling when you think about the jars that you could smell the flowers. You could hold them up under the light and see the crystals, the beauty of them. And that's gone. A patient or a recreational user of marijuana cannot go into the dispensary anymore and look at what they are buying. I mean, these products are more important than tomatoes, and you can go to a farmer's market and pinch those and look and smell, or melons or whatever. And this product is so beautiful, and there's so much to it that the consumer is being cut off from that experience.
All right, again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I'm here with Miguel Gavilan Molina. He has been in the middle of this for a long time, and we're going to see if we can get him on the microphone in one moment. But let's bring in another aspect of the rollout, and that has to do more with the medicinal. And welcome to the microphones, Chris Conrad, a longtime advocate, people's right to cannabis and the medicinal use of cannabis. So remind people, give us a sense of the rollout and remind people about what CBD is and what people need to know about it and its availability or lack thereof.
Okay. I'd just like to clarify on Loris's statement there that it's not that the Emerald Cup is going to be gone. It's that relationship that typifies it of the growers and the patients and consumers getting together, that's what's going to be missing. It'll be more like retail outlets that will be exhibiting their wares. So please come to the Emerald Cup. Anyway, I think that what we've seen in the rollout has been some bad faith on the part of the localities and law enforcement in particular, on a lesser scale with the regulators, because the initiative was actually written in a way that was designed to help small growers to keep their place here. It was essentially designed to kind of grandfather in the smaller growers. But what happened instead was that the people issuing the licenses have chosen to aggregate licenses and also to make the cost of getting in so high that people can't do it.
Right.
The other thing that I think – you have to look at is the situation that in Oregon where they did kind of the opposite. And what they've done there is they've licensed a lot of growers. California's overregulated, but Oregon, they've really issued a lot of licenses. And now they're estimating that the amount of production from the licensed market comes to about 4 pounds a year per adult consumer there. And so we were up there and we're seeing ounces for $40, in fact. And whereas down here, we go to the shop and it's $45 for an eighth, you know. So the difference between those is pretty so in other words, their answer lies somewhere between the two processes. But yet the overall issue is that the economy here that we built was a traditionally small-scale growers and – through the collective process, the legislature got rid of the collectives effective of January the 9th of next year. And so that's left us with only the regulated versus the personal growers and so forth. And so this has created a problem. And one of the problems, I think, for a lot of the smaller growers that were part of the collective system is not only can they not fit into the current paradigm of licensing, but they also the amount of out-of-state shipping that they used to do is going to put them at a big risk, a higher risk, as the state starts to crack down on these smaller growers. Because a lot of what's been growing to keep our economy going has been small grows and some out-of-state shipping to keep the value right for the growers. Now, a lot of the country still doesn't have marijuana. Kansas does. You know, they have laws that you can get it, but they don't have a way of getting it. So there's a solution there, but we're years away from solving it.
All right. Again, special edition of Flashpoints. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're here with Miguel Gavila Molina. He's been on the front lines of this story for a very long time, many different angles. And we're just doing we're sort of rolling out our panel for you, if you will, and trying to hit different angles. And maybe before we get to Miguel, let's just let Sarah jump in from her side. And then, Miguel, I want you to work the panel over. From your perspective. Okay. Welcome, Sarah Schrader. It's always great to have you there. You can move that microphone closer. I'm hoping that this is going over the radio. My headphones aren't working, but I hope you can hear me across
the... Thank you so much for having me here today.
Across this little pond. It's good to have you with us. You've been in this a long time. Tell us a little bit about what Americans for Safe Access have been honing in on since the rollout. There have been some, you know, I introduced the show, I have to admit, it was not cynical, but honestly, we're going to spend the entire hour on the highly flawed rollout of the legal cannabis industry. That's a gentle way, from my perspective, highly flawed, particularly for the folks who need it most.
I think the hardest part for medical cannabis patients has been the cost, and that's specifically related to the taxes and the permit structure that we currently have. When we go to the dispensaries, as Chris mentioned, the cost is really high, and when you put that additional tax burden on the customer who's using this patient on cannabis on a regular basis for their quality of life, that's not like a recreational consumer. That's not someone we should put the burden on. Most of these patients were depending on this collective model that Chris described, where patients could get affordable medicine through growing and sharing their resources. Without that model being in place, their options are to cultivate themselves or to purchase at a dispensary. In order to get a tax reduction, a patient has to go get a state identification, and that's some extra steps and extra burdens that are specifically for patients who shouldn't have to have these extra regulatory procedures on them.
All right. How is the organization dealing with the situation? How are you sort of taking names and numbers, complaints? How are you surveying the people who are being hurt most? How are you sort of carrying the people's perspective.
I think that the organization has always been a resource for education. And as we put together a new structure and have new regulatory processes in place, they're looking to show the industry and other people in the community how to go through that process. Americans for Safe Access early on hooked up with American Herbal Products Association and created a best standards for cannabis when it came to manufacturing, laboratory practices, retail, as well as cultivation. And we knew that regulation was coming early on, which is why we tailored and developed policies specifically with organizations that worked on other plant and herbal matter. It makes sense that we're going to have to go through regulation, but these regulations are more and more excessive financially, which is taking out a lot of our small players.
All right, and one final question on the rollout. Many, many, many people put their lives on the line, went to jail so that we could all, you know, be able to feel better. And many of us really needed to feel better. So these were folks who took great risks and brought great comfort to millions of people. Some of them are rotting in jail. I don't imagine many of them will have a shot at the business, if you will. And I suspect there'll be a lot more people being arrested because all these laws, regulations, this sort of troubled rollout is pushing the industry back underground. So we can expect more arrests, I guess, soon, too.
I expect less criminal activity and more civil fines, and those costs are going to be very burdensome. Certainly enforcement is going to be more in the civil realm than criminal. Yes. Because of the new context here, but that's going to have a huge impact again on our small players because of those regulatory measures.
All right.
I'll just say on that note, you know, there are sort of ways that the infractions can grow into crimes eventually, but the short term is going to be losing your home. You may not end up in a jail cell where you get fed, but you may lose your home and your ability to feed yourself. And so it will look slightly different. I think this is now a civil procedure of taking people's livelihoods and putting them out of their homes. It doesn't feel very civil to me, but, you know, the war on drugs renamed, I suppose.
And there are ways that we could potentially help our communities because we have the authority to write local regulations. If you look at the example of San Francisco, they are creating an equity plan specifically for people who have been arrested for cannabis or family members arrested for cannabis. If other local jurisdictions have that authority, then we can certainly help those who have risked civil disobedience on our behalf by allowing them to become key players in the future.
And if I can get in this too, Chris here, that the other thing that with the initiative is that it got rid of 9 felonies and it created a series of wobblers, which is what Hezekiah was talking about. It's no longer a felony to grow marijuana, but if you cut down or you kill an endangered species in the course of it, then it becomes a felony and so forth. And so we've seen like a 74% reduction in felony arrests here. Because of the structure of the law, I don't see there being a big increase in that coming forward, but we're going to see a lot of, I think, misdemeanor arrests. And this brings me to 2 different points. One is that as long as marijuana is on the controlled substance list here in California, then people who get arrested for any of the felony violations have to register as drug offenders, which then has huge ramifications on the rest of their lives in terms of education, loans, getting licenses, and so forth, and even simple things like making cannabis extract. One thing I kind of like to, and if I could toss this to Hezekiah, is that when it comes to the question of arrests and so forth, I know that the people who have licenses are now, in some cases, advocating for more of an enforcement against the people without licenses, and for an understandable reason. They want to draw people into the legal market. But I just went from Hezekiah. How do you see that balancing out between the people trying to make the transition and the people who already have licenses?
The vast majority of businesses that I represent, whether licensed or unlicensed, believe that our task and our mission is to ensure that everybody who sacrificed to get us to this point have a pathway forward. The businesses that we hear calling for enhanced enforcement are oftentimes newcomers and or very well capitalized. The people who are feeling secure in their market share are saying, everything's great, crack down, and let's expand our market share. The rest of us are still fighting the same struggle that we always have. I would say, obviously, our membership is sort of biased. You know, we have organizing principles of inclusion and of general participation. Our membership is 95-5. Enforcement is good with clear priorities. Public lands, for example. Absolutely no reason whatsoever that we should continue allowing commercial use of the public lands in this manner. Trespass grows are another great example. But when it comes to somebody who's just growing cannabis to try to get by, somebody who is a collective a year or still is until January 9th, but in that sort of declining area, you know, those folks, we need opportunity. Enforcement without opportunity is a failed paradigm. That's what we learned over the last 30 years, and we are not extending that opportunity fast enough.
Lourdes.
Yes, I have a question that's related to employee discrimination, and I'd like to know, Hezekiah, do you know if it is allowed for an employer to forbid an employee to use marijuana at the workplace if they are, well, either recreational or medical?
You know, honestly, I'll look back to Chris on this one, the real expert here. My understanding is that, yes, their employment discrimination is still very much allowed. We did see legislation this year that would have taken that on. That legislation was unsuccessful.
Yeah, in fact, I would even say to Sarah here, it was Ross versus Burning Wire. Raging
Wire, yes. No. Americans for Safe Access challenged this in court and unfortunately lost this challenge. That same day, Mark Leno had introduced legislation that would have fixed it. And even though we had that passed by our state legislation, it was Arnold Schwarzenegger who refused to sign that bill. So since then, we've had other introductions of other employment bills, and we're certainly prioritizing that on behalf of medical cannabis patients as well. If housing, employment aren't secure, then it's going to be really difficult to say that patients have access when those type of things could be at risk. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And I have a question and also a major concern. And that is that there's been so much confusion. And when the adult recreational kicked in January of this year, it sent up, you know, alarms everywhere. And now we see it. There are, you know, every county, and sometimes within counties, cities have their own rules, have their own regulations. There's no conformity across the board. And that can be a huge problem. Yes.
I agree. It was really simple to educate medical cannabis patients when policies were the same across the state. We had a simple policy where you could have 6 mature plants, 12 immature plants, or 8 ounces, but your jurisdiction or your doctor could allow more. That was easy to do education on. Now when someone calls me and asks me what they're allowed to have in their jurisdiction, I literally have to ask them for their zip code and get back to them in a few days. There's not a simple blanket policy. The reason because of that is the two major opponents in Sacramento over the last 20 years have been the League of Cities and Counties as well as our Police Chiefs Association. They want to keep that authority within the cities and counties, and that was part of what the regulations that were built is that cities or counties can create their rules fit for their communities, but it makes it difficult as an educator to tell people how to follow the law when it ranges so differently from city to city, county to county.
And there's no fairness at all in taxation. I mean, here you have a crop that's been recognized as agricultural, you know, crop in California, cannabis. And yet it's treated differently. I mean, you see alcohol, for instance, you know, be it wine, beer, or hard liquor. I mean, in bottles out there, you know, it's readily available to everybody, nothing special. And yet the tax is conformed amongst that industry. But here, you have this new agricultural crop that's finally been recognized, and there's no conformity. You know, Southern California has its own set of rules, up here has a set of rules, and the taxation. I mean, in some places, cities have more taxes than the county. I mean, so you have all of this. When can we see some light at the end of this? And then there's the issue. And I know Hezekiah has been battling, you know, through the California Growers Association, trying to get, you know, at least half a dozen different bills out there to protect the small cottage industry, the original growers, the, you know, used to be outlaws or still are. And yet, you know, you have, I believe, the United Cannabis Association, which is a business group. They don't care. You know, they're in it for commercial and corporatization of the cannabis industry in California. So I know that there was recently something major defeat, Hezekiah,
yep,
dealing with sales and marketing. And a lot of these cottage industry, these small growers, that's how people have been able to make their livelihood, going to events, going to, you know, festivals, going to gatherings. Now that's all illegal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What?
you know, exactly as Lourdes was saying earlier, beyond the cultural value of engaging in that direct exchange with the person who grew the thing that you're going to consume, whether it's a carrot or cannabis, there's a magic in knowing what love went into it. And so, you know, for over the last 10 years or so, a lot of the smallest growers had come to rely on some amount of direct-to-consumer sales, events like the Emerald Cup. Right. I agree with Chris. It's still going to be a great event. We should still go. Right. But behind the scenes, it's going to look very different. Mm-hmm. The legislation that we introduced as our highest priority this year would have allowed for small growers and small manufacturers to participate in those types of events. And as you mentioned, Miguel, it was a group of retailers who opposed the bill. And ultimately, you know, it was a two-thirds bill. So it was a very steep uphill climb. We needed to get a lot of Republican support in order to put the pieces together. So it was a very vulnerable bill. We got the police chiefs on board. We got the League of Cities on board. Yes. You know, we've been working this bill for 3 years. We've done a lot of hard work in the trenches to get to a point where we thought it was time. And at the end of the day, it was retailers who wanted to protect their market share. And so we're starting to see a fragmentation within the cannabis community itself where, you know, for us, we're still trying to get our folks lifelines. Folks are losing their homes. They're losing their livelihoods. This is still very much a struggle. And there are other people that feel good enough that they want to close it down and start building theirs. And it's very challenging.
All right. You're listening to a special edition of Flashpoints. My name is Dennis Burns, and I'm here with Miguel Gavilan Molina and a distinguished panel of folks who are experts on every aspect of the marijuana, the cannabis rollout that took place officially January 1st. This is an incredibly important story, and it's going to change the history of this state. We really wanted to spend a bunch of time on it. What we're going to do here is we're going to take a short musical break, and then we're going to sort of let everybody who's here, the panel, Ezekiah Allen, Chris Conrad, Sarah Schrader, Loris Mota, we're going to let them sort of ask each other questions, see if we can find out what it is we've missed so far. So short musical break. Dennis Berenstein with Miguel Gavilan Molina. We will be right back. Please don't move. Rollout, to evaluating the rollout of recreational use of marijuana in California. It is, it was being used, it was legalized for medicinal use first, and then this year we saw it roll out recreationally. That's what they call it anyway. It has huge impact on the culture, on the finances. We're not really going to be getting into the social side of this, but that's huge as well, the transformation that this has at the cultural level. level. There's so much to talk about. But what I wanted to do, since I've got four great – Miguel and I have four great people who have been spending a lot of time from various angles looking at this, I wanted to give you all a chance to each other – ask each other questions. Did you want to start?
I do,
Lourdes,
yeah.
Please. This is Lourdes Mukta.
Thank you.
She's a longtime cannabis farmer.
Thank you very much. I'd like to ask all of you to comment on this. May we discuss the League of Cities challenge to the BCC's draft permanent regulation establishing statewide delivery, including delivery services into banned counties, pros and cons for statewide delivery?
I mean, what are you talking about? Because I don't know.
So, you know, just to provide some context there, the licensing agencies at the state are in the midst of their rulemaking process. Up until now, we've been operating under a set of rules that were passed using emergency authority. And so now we're going through the full regular rulemaking process. It involves a public comment period, et cetera. And, you know, as Lourdes mentioned, one of the regulations that was new in that draft was a regulation that said very simply, a licensee may deliver into any city or county in California. This cuts straight to the core of California constitutional law. I'm not a lawyer, but I've talked with several of them. And, you know, California was a system of city-states prior to being sort of enfranchised or incorporated into the republic that is now the California Republic. And so part of that constitution several, you know, 150 years ago was a lot of reserve powers for cities and counties. We don't see it, but a city could ban carrots. A city could ban chickens. My city bans male chickens. And so this type of home rule and police power is something that cities and counties claim to have across the board. It's not often we see a substance like cannabis that they're choosing to exercise that authority. And so, you know, this is going to cut deep. I think that the courts will be the ones to decide it. To me, Californians have a universal human right to medicine. I think it gets slightly more slippery when we talk about adult use. But as you said, you know, Dennis, what is really recreational cannabis and where's the line? So I believe in my heart of hearts that everyone should have access to this plant. My family's given a lot to that over the decades. And at the end of the day, I think the courts are going to have a tough time sorting it out.
And if I could chime in there, one of the issues here is exactly what Hezekiah was talking about there. Our Constitution says that the local governments have a lot of authority, on zoning in particular, that they can control what's going on inside of their borders and so forth. And the initiative could have overridden it, but they didn't because they thought they would get too much resistance for that. This is really kind of a NIMBY bill, I mean, NIMBY situation. But there was a bill in the legislature, and somebody else can maybe give me a better update on it, but that was that's going to allow that. I believe it's passed and is waiting for the governor to sign, or did that one get
voted on? SB 1302, unfortunately, would have dealt with this issue, and that was held in committee. And we think that the regulatory response is this new rule. We think that's where this energy was sort of picked up.
Okay, but so that lacking, I think that the other alternative is, and I know you're talking about not growing on state land, but I think that we have big parts of the state, a huge segment of the state, where there's just no retail available. But we do have – the state owns property in all those places, and I think they should be licensing people to sell marijuana on state property where the cities are not allowing them to, because we need more retail around the state. If people are growing it and processing it and they don't have anywhere to sell it, that's going to be obviously a problem, and it's going to force people out of business or to out of state. And so if the localities won't step up to the plate, then the legislature should allow licensed sales on state property.
Go, Sarah.
I'm concerned about patients because if they're living in an area that don't have medical cannabis dispensaries, they're currently required to travel quite far in order to procure their medicine. What this bill or what this proposal in the Bureau regulations would do was ensure that patients have access in every city and every county across the state. We did see a bill earlier this year that would have allowed that, and because that didn't pass, this seems like it was another solution that was introduced. However, I think from the cities and counties, I think they're concerned that they might not be getting the tax revenue from these sales. And in order for them to get that tax revenue, they have to create these ordinances for the sales to exist. Right now, we only have a few of our cities and counties pushing forward to allow these permit structures. And those are the ones that are going to reap the financial reward from these taxes.
Real quick, I just want to say, if there happen to be any folks involved with city or county governments out there, you know, who might be listening, there's sort of a basic truth here.
you can ban unregulated cannabis, or excuse me, you can ban regulated cannabis, but it's impossible to ban cannabis. Everyone in California has access to it. These prohibitionist policies at the local level, all they do is prevent the good actors from moving forward. We really need to come to terms with that basic fact. Cannabis is not going to leave our communities. It is there. Do we want licensed folks paying their taxes, selling it, growing it, manufacturing it with safety procedures that are going through testing and everything that the law includes? Or do we want business as usual? That's the choice that we have. We don't have yes cannabis, no cannabis.
I have a question that directly relates to us as small farmers, and it's relating to the testing process. What can be done to postpone implementation of phase three testing, given that there are currently no labs that are even doing phase three testing, research and development, and it appears that they will be even worse bottlenecks with the little or no functioning labs who will be ready for January 2019, mm-hmm. phase three testing standards and implementation.
So
put the phases
put it into context again here.
Phase one, phase two. Well, we don't know what phase three is.
Sure. So
what the phase is, you know.
Phase one started on January 1st of this year, and it involved some really toxic substances, some of the worst pesticides that had been observed in common use, you know, your banned substances, your known problematic. The phase two kicked in on July 1st. That involved a much bigger suite of pesticides. It included, you know, a bit more detail. Phase three is going to be a very detailed approach to testing, very rigorous, most rigorous agricultural products testing of any product in the world, frankly. That will kick in as currently slated on January 1st of 2019. This will include heavy metals testing. It will include a much broader suite of pesticides, even beyond what there is in phase two now. And, you know, what can be done to delay that? I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, but we're actually fighting to make sure it doesn't get worse. We're facing another round of public comments right now from, you know, some of those very same businesses I mentioned that are seeing higher barriers as a way to protect their market share. We're seeing a suggestion, you know, all respect to the city of Berkeley where the studio is here, but we're seeing a suggestion that we would return to the Berkeley regulations. The Berkeley regulations are notorious for small growers because any product that was grown using a compost tea will automatically fail. Compost teas use beneficial bacteria. Under these testing regime, any bacteria would fail the product. It's essentially a sterilization of cannabis. And so it's actually, you know, not only are we not in a position to look for a more reasonable timeline, we might be facing more backsliding on this issue. And so, you know, my fundamental concern over the last few years is that too much too fast would destroy our marketplace. And, you know, this is one
too
of those...
Too much too fast in regulation?
In regulation. Too much
testing cost. Those of us who've always believed that it's important to have stringent regulation, I don't want to, you know, the burden of this chemistry in my body because I'm trying to feel better based on, you know, this new vision of marijuana. So this is a confusing and problematic situation. Is it the case that the richer, the sort of the, if you will, the industrials who have a lot of money and a lot of influence can do the testing better? Will the industrials make more safer material for our use because they have the money to do it? They haven't done it in the past on other regards. But you know what I'm saying here? This is not an easy thing to understand.
You know, and it's not. And what we've been advising and what we think, you know, what the science, you know, Sarah mentioned the herbal products pharmacopoeia earlier. What the science says is test for pathogens. E. coli, that's a known pathogen. Aspergillus, known pathogens. These are what we should be testing for. A general count of bacterial activity, that's just going to fail anything with bacterial activity, which is quite literally anything that hasn't been sterilized.
And if I could jump in there again, this is Chris Conrad, that the thing that you really hit, Hezekiah, is that we got to comment to the board. We got to get the public out there. So it's not just all businesses' interest because the consumer is involved too. And we're in a kind of an odd position because when most things come along, it comes to pesticides, there's a limited amount that is allowed in there. And sometimes you say, well, I don't want any rat feces in my food, but, you know, the fact is that the law allows that to occur, and the reason is it's a practical concern that you just – there's only a certain amount of purity as possible. When it comes to cannabis, they're saying any trace of anything gets it thrown out. And then if you look again at the difference between what happened in Oregon versus what's happening in California, in Oregon, what they did was when they – as they phase in each new stage of testing, they allow the companies to get rid of the rest of their material with a label that says not compliant to the next phase, and then the new ones come in with that, that are compliant. California, on the other hand, we had to destroy millions of dollars of inventory, and somebody else can say what number there is an estimate on that, that, you know, could have been relabeled, perhaps could have been retested and given to these patients who are out of luck right now because of the cholesterol is getting shut down.
I also have concern about the fact that the testing cost is so high. It really encourages larger batches. We're allowed to test on up to 50-pound batches. Yes. But when the cost is so high, there's really an incentive to test a larger batch as opposed to a smaller batch. And what that's going to do is impact our artisanal small farmers who have had a history of growing medically a variety of strains that have had a lot of different medical benefits to them.
Absolutely. That affects us directly. We used to have 16 different strains that we grew in small batches, and this was the following that we had in the community, and that's gone. There's no way to economically just even think about that.
I heard a quote yesterday that the new testing regulations on cannabis are stricter than baby food.
Yep. Wow. Absolutely. In fact, there are several baby foods on the shelf that would fail our testing, our phase one testing, actually. Some of the commercially available baby food does fail. The public comment period ends on Monday, and so we are right in crunch time. And to this question, you know, we are working to hold the line from the testing requirements, getting any more sort of pesticide focused and any more of an inhibition to small growers. We do also have a program that we've put together based on Oregon's program that would allow for small batch testing. It would allow terpenes, flavonoids, potency to be batched into a larger batch. So you could essentially pay for one 50-pound batch, but then break that out into several composite tests on terpenes and potency. And so we think that that could bring the cost down significantly. If you are so inclined, calgrowersassociation.org/regulations. We've got a number of issues of this nature that are highlighted there. And, you know, we'd love everyone to take a look before Monday if it's of interest.
You know, I remember last December with the cup up in the Sonoma County fairgrounds. We were there for the duration, I think it was, 3 days of activity. And I remember reading something afterwards that, the cannabis cup, that apparently over 60% of those that participated in the cannabis cup failed, the testing. And some of them that, actually were up in the top 10, some of them even had found traces of stuff that, wouldn't have cleared. So it's interesting. Again, the problem with that is that the state and then districts and then, local areas and the counties and then municipalities, there's no, communication amongst those groups. Everyone is trying to figure out the law, trying to put it into context. And, so you talk to one, then you talk to another, and there's conflicting or nobody knows. There is tremendous lag time on the state level for getting itself together. So, outside of that, wanting something that's clean, something that's safe for human consumption, cannabis, medicine, I also have another concern, and that is, I know that there's been, earlier I said, over half a dozen different pieces of legislation. But in it all, and I know talking with Lourdes and some other folks, there's always the question about equity in the industry. From growers to distributors to marketing to production to owners to farmers, all of that. There's a big gap. I like to know what is being done. I know that Oakland passed certain, rules a couple of years back that said, hey, if we're going to be giving any more permits, they're going to be done with the idea of equity, that communities of color or those communities that have done served time in jail, have done prison time because they were growing either to supplement their miserable incomes or just to stay alive afloat or provide themselves with medicine. You know, some of them went to jail. Some of them have been out. And I have still to hear of a general statewide program that erases people's, you know, records for having, you know, been a small grower and so forth. And also the permit process. How are cities? I know San Francisco has been tackling that issue. I know folks in L.A. in different areas, there's a lot of uproar that the industry is dominated, but there's very little women and communities of color. What is being done, especially in your positions, to address that?
Thank you, Miguel. That was my next question. Thank you.
I can address it specifically for San Francisco. I sit on the state cannabis legalization task force there, and this is an issue that we were looking at quite immensely. The San Francisco Human Rights Commission really wanted to focus on the multi-generational impact of the drug war. What that means is that if someone in your family has been jailed or incarcerated, then what does that mean for that family at that point in time, 10 years later, 20 years later, or even 30 years later? If someone doesn't have a second family member there to support them financially, that impacts people's schooling, it impacts their career, it impacts them long term. And so the Human Rights Commission was really focused on how to rectify that. We on the task force had identified three different reasons why many minorities were not participating. One is they didn't have the education, two is they didn't have the experience, and three is they didn't have the money. We were looking at the City College to be an option for education. We already have free education for San Francisco residents, so we're looking at adding a regimen there of cannabis education. Two is experience. So looking at a way to provide internships or apprenticeships so that people can get that hands-on experience. And three is finances. So what we were going to do is put together a fund in San Francisco so people could actually have a loan to get that money, because banking will not necessarily provide that to us at this time. Unfortunately, two changes were made at the very last minute when this ordinance was passed. One is they decided to give that funding away to the organizations fixing the drug war implications, so that money was no longer available for minorities for the loans. And two is that they changed it from drug arrests to only cannabis arrests. And if you look at the arrest history in San Francisco for cannabis, it's been pretty minor compared to other drugs. And those people that have had other drug arrests have actually had longer term impacts. So while they had really good intent to draft something that was going to have a good impact, those two small editorial changes at the last minute really change the whole intent behind it. And those are the things we need to be very careful about when we're talking about implementation of these types of structures. In an area like Sonoma, I see equity looking very differently. We're not necessarily looking at race. We're looking at ways to get those small farmers back in the playing field.
And what we're talking about, to let everybody know who's listening out in the radio audience, is marijuana is the rollout of the cannabis, the recreational cannabis program here in California. And, well, as much as we've seen happen in California, cannabis is still illegal on the federal level. And we have to spend a few minutes on banking. The state of California just rejected, they didn't give a full go ahead to a new the possibility of a public bank. Now, folks who are in this business, who are actually in retail, don't know what the hell to do with all the cash because they can't get banks with federal, who have to obey federal laws to participate. So this is a big problem here.
So I just want to mention on that bill, SB 930, that the woman we expect to be incoming state treasurer, Fiona Ma, had sponsored that. That bill was unsuccessful, but I think in part it was unsuccessful because the current state treasurer, John Chung, was able to identify funding to move forward with a full feasibility study. And so essentially the legislation would have moved into feasibility study in 2019, maybe into implementation in 2020. And so this might actually get us there a little bit faster. And with the treasurer's office really taking such a strong leadership position, I actually actually think that there is reason for optimism despite
talk
the bill's
about,
failure.
Step back and talk about what that really means
sure.
to the industry. And anybody else who wants to jump in after this, please
sure.
do.
I mean, you know, just to make it really personal, access to banking would mean getting a mortgage, paying tuition, getting health insurance, all of those things that, you know, being one of those Californians that grew up with parents in and out of jail for cannabis, who grew up not having access to these assets, this is a very human reality for us. And every day you're faced with these challenges. And so, you know, it's a really fundamental step to normalization. We're not going to overcome the stigma and the prejudice until we can behave normally. And part of that is on us to sort of grow out of being marginal. But part of that is also to start breaking down the persistent structural marginalization, like no access to banking. If I get paid and I have to carry $8,000 in cash home, I'm way more likely to get something bad happen than if I can get direct deposit and go to the bank. I mean, just every single day, this is something that keeps us from integrating more thoroughly.
That's right. When it comes to federal law, I've gone to Washington, D.C. for 7 years in a row trying to work on congressional lobbying related to medical cannabis with Americans for Safe Access. And there's two things that we were pushing for this year. One is the Careers Act. This would take THC to Schedule 2, take CBD off schedule, allow for banking, allow for veterans access, allow for research. And then the second thing that we were really promoting is our campaign, which is End Pain, Not Lives. Right now, we have a lot of people that are dying of opiate use, and we think that cannabis can not only be a first line for people that are that need pain control, but also help people that have addiction issues. And we have issued a report that really outlines how this could be beneficial at the larger level. And we're seeing the federal government focus on some of these opioids as campaigns because of the fact that we are seeing so much impact right now, even in our smaller communities.
And if I can jump in there again, the problem with the banking is, of course, that cannabis is in the Controlled Substances Act, the federal criminal justice code. And so I blanch at the word justice when I say it. But in any case, we're in a situation now where the DEA has persistently refused to change the scheduling for cannabis. Part of that is because the paradigm that they use for approving medicine in the United States, which is a lock on by pharma, big pharma. And so cannabis being a plant is much more complicated than the process for drugs legalization really fits in. If you look at like what's going on with Epidiolex and Sativex, these are two plant single compound applications that have been from Europe that are one of it is approved already here and one of it is going to likely to be approved, I should say. And so this is kind of what the government looks like at as medicine. And that's why we need to get cannabis out of the controlled substances list completely, because it's not going to fit into Schedule 2 or Schedule 3 either. And so what I'm suggesting to people is quite simple, is that the one guy who can really do something about this is Donald Trump. And so much as I dislike the guy, he could be pressured, especially if he knows that Pete Sessions, it would really get Pete Sessions goat if he
took
it.
You mean Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III.
They're both bad, but okay. Jeff Sessions is who I met, the Attorney General. And so, you know, I'm really urging people who are listening to write a letter to the White House, very flattering. You don't tell Trump that you hate him. You say, look, you'll be the greatest president ever if you get marijuana out of the controlled substances list. Play to his ego and his revengeful personality, and we can get what we want out of him. That doesn't mean we have to like him, and hopefully we don't vote for him. But I think this is an opportunity. We have to admit. Maybe I shouldn't use the word manipulate, but essentially that's what it is. We know how to make him do things. We need to act that way.
Putting Pinocchio aside, I just wanted to say that, you know, we have a situation here in California, and it's one thing that I've really been concerned for the last month or so. You know, once again, like last year, we have fires raging in Northern California, where it's some of the most prime area for natural outdoor grows. And the question I have is there a mechanism from the state to provide agricultural insurance for some of these growers, farmers that have registered themselves, you know, have taken part in, you know, abided by their county rules, paid the permits, the license, et cetera,
et cetera. We have a minute to respond to that.
Unfortunately not. We are seeing more private insurance carriers underwrite crops, especially after last year. We saw a lot of majors step up and start doing those risk calculations. But at this point, the state programs are still not, federal programs especially, are still not accessible.
Some local cities and counties have crop loss programs, but that doesn't necessarily reimburse them when or if they fail testing. It's when the crop itself is impacted and they can show that on site.
And at a number of the conferences, they've been people from the insurance industry who say they won't insure against a federal rate or anything, but they will insure against fire losses and things like that.
All right, final statements from the gut. You each have 30 seconds. What's at the heart of the matter? Let's go.
You know, for me, I think the heart of the matter is it's time to be optimistic and it's time to work hard. This is not going well. We've managed to bungle this one despite, I think, a lot of our best warnings, but it can get better. You know, there's a lot of great legislation moving, a statewide equity program, cannabis cooperatives for the first state in the country that will allow these agricultural producers co-ops. There's a lot of reason for hope and optimism. There is a lot of hard work still to do. California, we might have passed it, but it's not legal yet.
All right, Chris Conrad, a lot of breakthroughs. We've heard some incredibly beautiful things happening in terms of the real medicinal uses.
Right. And I think that one of the things that we're going to see in that regard is that in order to have the access to the full plant product, we can't count on the federal government's medical programs to do that. We have to be through our cannabis system as it's designed, whether it be medical or whether it be adult use. But I think the other thing I want to say is that, first off, read the Leaf on, go to leafonline.com sometimes to read our news. But the other thing is that the whole I shouldn't have said
you
that.
You got to do it. You got 5 seconds. I think we're going to move on.
Home grows and share with your friends. That's what I'm
all right. Okay, that's good.
Give it away.
I think ACE has been working on a couple of influential things for patients for a long time. One of those is housing protections, and the other one is employment. Another thing that I'd really like to see passed is SB 1127, which is Jerry Hill's bill. This would allow for parents to be able to use cannabis on site, although we do need to see some amendments that would improve that bill for parents.
Beautiful. And the...
I'd like to thank you very, very much. It was an honor to be here amongst all of you and allow some of my questions to be asked. And I am optimistic, and we are fighters, and we're not going away. So look for Stagecoach Flowers, and I welcome you to try some.
What a beautiful sharing. This is Miguel. Miguel, you get 8 seconds.
Si se puede.
Si se puede. I'm Dennis Bernstein. You've been listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Mike Biggs is at the board. Falcone Molina is at the other board. And we're out of here.
And look for my flower, Lourdes.
That wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at DennisJBernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
In 1989, Spike Lee made a film that spoke truth to power. It's called Do the Right Thing, and its message and urban aesthetic echoes today as gentrification resonates through our neighborhoods. The film takes place on the hottest day of the year in Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn, where everyone's frustrations smolder and build until it explodes into violence.
Boycott Sound.
Go.
Yo, boycott Sound.
I got your boycott swing.
Boycott Sound.
Join KPFA and our partner, the New Parkway Theater in Oakland, Saturday, August 25th at 3 p.m. for the groundbreaking film, Do the Right Thing. Director Spike Lee's powerful portrait of urban racial tensions features an ensemble cast that includes Danny Aiello, Ruby Dee, John Turturro, Rosie Perez, and Samuel L. Jackson. Get your tickets today at the New Parkway Theater on 24th Street in Oakland or online at kpfa.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Howard Zinn talks about America's wars and the mindset that gets us into those wars. I hope you'll stay tuned. We continue with part two of historian Howard Zinn's fine speech of 2008. He spoke in Binghamton, New York, 3 days after the presidential election. In last week's installment, Zinn scolds our government for not even trying to establish real social justice. Social justice as defined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That would include, among other things, guaranteed health care, fair wages for all workers, adequate housing, and a clean environment. Zinn identifies two major obstacles to social justice in the United States. One, entrenched economic interests, and two, the government's obscenely high spending on the military. In this week's installment, Zinn focuses on the bloated military and the absurd imperialist wars that the United States has been fighting. He speaks of the faulty American mindset, including President-elect Obama's mindset, that supports all these needless wars. Here are some elements Zinn identifies of that mindset. Belief in American exceptionalism. Denial of our imperialism. False patriotism. Faulty definitions of national security and the national interest, and a false definition of heroism. Speaking of, candidate Donald Trump was lambasted by the establishment and all the establishment media for saying that John McCain was no military hero. Trump was denounced by left and right for saying that being captured and imprisoned in war does not in itself constitute heroism. Trump's words lacked tact, but I have always felt that he was entirely correct. Well, 8 years before Trump disputed McCain's heroism, Air Force veteran Howard Zinn did the same. You'll hear that passage today. Zinn's talk is titled, The Power to Change. Here is part two.
No, we have to speak what we believe is the truth. And I think the truth is we should not be at war. We should not be at war at all. These wars are absurd. They're horrible. Also, they're horrible and they're absurd. From a human point of view, they're horrible. You know, the deaths and the mangled limbs and the blindness and 3 million people in Iraq losing their homes, having to leave their homes. 3 million people. Imagine having to look elsewhere to live because of our occupation, because of our war for democracy, our war for liberty, our war for whatever it is we're supposed to be fighting for. No, we need a president who will say, yeah, I'm giving advice to Obama. I know he's listening. But, you know, if enough people speak up, he will listen, right? If enough people speak up, he will listen. No, there's much more of a chance of him listening, right, than those other people. They're not listening. They wouldn't listen. Obama could possibly listen if we, all of us, and the thing to say is, we have to change our whole attitude as a nation towards war, militarism, violence. We have to declare that we are not going to engage in aggressive wars. We are going to renounce the Bush doctrine of preventive war. Oh, we have to go to, you know, we have to go to war on this little pitiful country, because this little pitiful country might someday do what? Attack us? I mean, Iraq might attack us? Well, they're developing a nuclear weapon, one, which they may have in 5 or 10 years. That's what all the experts said, even the experts on the government side. You know, they may develop one nuclear weapon in 5 years. Wow. The United States has 10,000 nuclear weapons. Nobody says, how about us? You see, you know all about that. Weapons of mass destruction, et cetera, et cetera. No. No reason for us to wage aggressive wars. We have to renounce war as an instrument of foreign policy. In really. And we save a lot of money. We have to dismantle the military bases we have all over the world. You know, this peace-loving country has troops in 100 different countries in the world. 100 different countries, we have military bases. That doesn't look like a peace-loving country. And besides, I mean, first of all, of course, it's very expensive. We save a lot of money. Do we really need those bases? What do we need those bases for? I can't figure out what we need those bases for, you know. So we have to, we have to give that up. And we have to declare ourselves a peaceful nation. We will no longer be a military superpower. Oh, that's terrible. There are people who think we must be a military superpower. We don't have to be a military superpower. We don't have to be a military power at all, you see. We can be a humanitarian superpower. Yeah. We'll still be powerful, we'll still be rich, but we can use that power and that wealth to help people all over the world. I mean, instead of sending helicopters to bomb people, send helicopters when they face a hurricane or an earthquake and they desperately need helicopters. You know, So, yeah, there's a lot of money available once you seriously, fundamentally change the foreign policy of the United States. Now, Obama has been hesitant to do that. And it has something to do with a certain mindset, because it doesn't have anything to do really with politics, that is with, more votes. Do you think most Americans know that we have bases in 100 countries? I'll bet you if you took a poll and asked among the American people, how many countries do you think we have bases in? Now, I don't know exactly what the answer is in, but I would guess, you know, there'd be like 5, 10. But I think most people would be surprised. In other words, there isn't a public demanding that we have bases in 100 countries, so there's no political advantage to that. Well, of course, there's economic advantage to corporations that supply those bases and build those bases and make profit from those bases, you know. And I do believe that the American people would welcome a president who said, we are not going to wage aggressive war anymore. The American people are not war-minded people. They become war-minded when a president gets up there and creates an atmosphere of hysteria and fear and, you know, and says, well, we must go to war. Then people, without thinking about it, without thinking, you know, why are we bombing Afghanistan? Because, Osama bin Laden is there. Where? Well, they don't really know. So we'll bomb the country. You know, if we bomb the country, maybe we'll get them. You see? Sure, in the process, thousands of Afghans will die, right? But so people didn't have time to stop and think. But the American people are not war-minded people. They would welcome, I believe, a turn away from war. So there's no real political advantage to that. But it has to do with a mindset, a certain mindset that, that a lot of Americans have, and that Obama, obviously, and the Democratic leadership, Pelosi and Harry Reid and the others, that they all still have. And when you talk about a mindset that they have, which stands in the way of the declaring against war, you're reminded that during the campaign, I don't know if you remember this, that at one point Obama said, and you know, there were many times in the campaign where he said really good things if he'd only followed up on them, you see, and if he only follows up on them now. But at one point in the campaign he said, it's not just a matter of getting out of Iraq. It's a matter of changing the mindset that got us into Iraq, you see. That was a very important statement. Unfortunately, he has not followed through by changing his mindset, you see. He knows somewhere and he expressed it, that we have to change our mindset, but he hasn't done it. Why? I don't know. It's because there are too many people around him and too many forces around him, and et cetera, that... But no, that mindset is still there. So I want to talk about what that mindset is, what the elements of that mindset are. I have to look at my watch. Not that it matters. Not that I care. But, you know, I feel conscience-stricken over keeping you here just to hear the truth. And here are some of the elements of the mindset that stand in the way for Obama, in the way for the Democratic Party, in the way for many Americans, in the way for us. And one of the elements in a mindset is the idea, somehow, that the United States is exceptional. In the world of the social science and, you know, that discipline called social science, there's actually a phrase for it that's called American exceptionalism. And what it means is the idea that the United States is unique in the world, you know, that we are different, that we, not just different, we're better, right? We are better than other people. Our society is better than other society. This is a very dangerous thing to think. When you become so arrogant that you think you are better and different than other countries in the world, then that gives you a carte blanche to do nasty things. You can do nasty things because you're better. You're justified in doing those things because we're different. What's that? I haven't heard that phrase since 1968. But it shows that progress is not lost. So we have to divest ourselves of the idea that, you know, we are somehow better. And, you know, we are the city on the hill, which is what the first governor of Massachusetts, Stamets, said. We are the Reagan also said that. Well, Reagan said lots of things, you know. Everybody looks to... No, we're an empire, like other empires. There was the British Empire, and there was the Russian Empire, there was the German Empire, and the Japanese Empire, and the French and the Belgian Empire, the Dutch Empire and the Spanish Empire, and now there's the American Empire. And our empire. And when we look at those empires, we say, oh, imperialism. But our empire, no. Yeah, there was one sort of scholar who wrote in the New York Times, said, we are an empire light. Light? Tell that to the people of Iraq. Tell that to the people in Afghanistan. Now, you know, we are an empire light. No, we are heavy. All you have to do is look at our history, and you'll see, no, our history does not show a beneficent country doing good all over the world. Our history shows expansion. Our history shows expansion. It shows us... it shows us moving into doubling our territory with the Louisiana Purchase, which I remember on our schoolroom maps looked very benign. Oh, there's all that empty land, and now we have it. It wasn't empty. There were people living there. There were Indian tribes. Hundreds of Indian tribes were living there, you see. And if it's going to be ours, we've got to get rid of them. And we did. We instigated a war with Mexico in 1846 to 1848, and at the end of the war, we take almost half of Mexico, you know. And why? We wanted that land. That's very simple. We want things. There's a drive of nations that have the power and the capacity to bully other nations. Tendency to expand into the areas that those other nations have. We see it all over the world. And the United States has done that again and again. And, you know, and then we expanded into the Caribbean, and then we expanded out into the Pacific with Hawaii and the Philippines. And of course, you know, in the 20th century, expanding our influence in Europe and Asia and now in the Middle East, everywhere. An expansionist country, an imperialist power. For what? To do good things for these other people? Or is it because we coveted? When I say we, I don't mean to include you and me. But I've gotten, you know, they've gotten us so used to identifying with the government. You know, like I say, we, like the janitor at General Motors says, we. No. No, the CEO of General Motors and the janitor are not we. No, we're not. Exceptionalism is one part of the mindset we have to get rid of. We have to see ourselves honestly for what we are. We're an empire like other empires. We're as aggressive and brutal and violent as the Belgians were in the Congo, as the British were in India, and all these other empires. Yeah. We're just like them. We have to face it. When you face that, you sober up a little, and then you don't think you can just go all over the world and say, oh, we're doing this for liberty and democracy. And Because then you, if you know the, you know your history, you know how many times that was said. Oh, we're going into the Philippines to bring civilization and Christianity to the Filipinos. We're going to bring civilization to the Mexicans, et cetera, et cetera. No. You'll understand that. That's a, yeah, that's one element in this mindset. And that, of course, when you say this, when you say these things, when you go back into the history, when you try to give an honest recounting of what we have been, not we really, what the government has done, our government has done. People haven't done it. People, we're just people. The government does these things, and then they try to include us and involve us in their criminal conspiracy. You know, we didn't do this, but they're dragooning us into this. But when you start criticizing, when you start making an honest assessment of what we have done in the world, they say you're being unpatriotic. Well, you have to. That's another part of the mindset you have to get rid of. Because if you don't, then you think you have to wear a flag in your lapel, or you think you have to always have American flags around you, and you have to show by your love for all this meaningless paraphernalia that you are patriotic. Well, that's, you know, an honest presidential candidate would not be afraid to say, you know, patriotism is not a matter of wearing a flag in your lapel, not a matter of this or a matter. Patriotism is not supporting the government. Patriotism is supporting the principles that the government is supposed to stand for. You know. You know, so we need to redefine these things which have been thrown at us and which we've imbibed without thinking, not thinking, oh, what really is patriotism? If we start really thinking about where this, then we will reject those cries that you're not patriotic and we'll say, patriotism is not supporting the government. When a government does bad things, the most patriotic thing you can do is to criticize the government, because that's the Declaration of Independence. That's our basic democratic charter. The Declaration of Independence says governments are set up by the people to, they're artificial creations. They're set up to ensure certain rights, the equal right to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. So when governments become destructive of those ends, the Declaration said, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish the government. That's our basic democratic charter. People have forgotten what it is. It's okay to alter or abolish the government when the government violates its trust. And then you are being patriotic. And when the government violates its trust, the government is being unpatriotic. So, yeah. Yeah, so we have to think about these, you know, these words and phrases that are thrown at us without giving us a time to think, and, you know, we have to redefine these words like national security. What is national security? Well, you say, well, this is for national security. Oh, that takes care of it. No, it doesn't take care of it. National security means different things to different people. There's some people, national security means having military bases all over the world. For other people, national security means having health care, having jobs. You know, that's security. So, yeah, we need to sort of redefine these things. You know, we need to redefine terrorism. Otherwise, the government can throw these words at us. Oh, we're fighting against terrorism. Oh, well, then I guess we have to do this. Wait a while. What do you mean by terrorism? Well, we sort of have an idea what terrorism means. Terrorism means that you kill innocent people for some belief that you have. Yeah, blowing up at 9/11, yeah, that was terrorist. But if that's the definition of terrorism, killing innocent people for some belief they have, then war is terrorism. You see. So we have to change our mindset. We have to stop thinking that solutions to problems are military solutions, that you can solve problems with violence. You can't really, don't really solve problems with violence. We have to change our definitions of heroism. Heroism in American culture so far, really, when people think of heroism, they think of military heroes. They think of the people, those whose statues are all over the country, you know. And they think of medals and battles. And, yeah, these are military heroes. And that's why Obama goes along with that definition of hero by referring to John McCain, you know, as a military hero, always feeling that he must do that. I never felt he must do that. John McCain, to my mind, and I know this is a tough thing to accept and may make some people angry, John McCain was tortured and bore up under torture and was a victim of torture and imprisonment, and that, you know, takes fortitude to do that. He's not a military hero. Before he was imprisoned, he dropped bombs on innocent people. He did what the other members of the Air Force did. They dropped bombs on peasant villages and killed a lot of innocent people. I don't consider that heroism. So we have to redefine. To me, the great heroes are the people who have spoken out against war. Those are the heroes, you know. Yeah, I think we have to change our mindset. We have to understand certain things that we haven't maybe thought about. I think one of the things we haven't thought about enough, because this is basic and this is crucial, we haven't realized, or at least not expressed it consciously, that the government's interests are not the same as our interests, really. And so when they talk about the national interest, they're creating what Kurt Vonnegut used to call a grand falloon. A grand falloon was so a meaningless abstraction in which you put things together that don't belong together. You see, a national security, national interest. No, there's no one national interest. There's the interest of the President of the United States, and then the interest of the young person he sends to war. They're different interests, you see. No, there's the interest of Exxon and Halliburton, and there's the interest of the worker, the nurse's aide, the teacher, the factory worker. Those are different interests. Once you recognize that you and the government have different interests, that's a very important step forward in your thinking, because if you think you have a common interest with the government, well, then it means that if the government says you must do this and you must do that and it's a good idea to go to war here, well, the government is looking out for my interest. No, the government is not looking out for your interest. The government has its own interests, and they're not the interests of the people. Not just true in the United States, it's true everywhere in the world. Governments generally do not represent the interests of their people. See? That's why governments keep getting overthrown. Because people at a certain point realize, hey, no, the government is not serving my interests. That's also why governments lie. Why do governments lie? And you must know that governments lie. Not just our government, governments in general lie. Why do they lie? They have to lie, because their interests are different than the interests of ordinary people. If they told the truth, they would be out of office. So, you know, have to recognize, you know, that the difference in interest.
Here again, we must pause Howard Zinn's fine address of 2008, The Power to Change. You'll recall that change was one of Barack Obama's campaign slogans. Zinn saw right off that what Obama was proposing to do was no real change, but rather more of the same, including war, war, and more war. For the original recording of Zinn, our thanks to Lynn Gary and the Unwelcome Guests Collective. I have snipped out some pauses and stumbles in the original talk. As always, thank you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, reminding you that they are few and we are many, advising that war is not healthy for children and other living things, and hoping you'll tune in again for the remainder of Zinn's talk next week. Till then.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
On today's show, you'll hear the second and final part of the speech given by Professor Peter Phillips discussing his new book, which will be released in August of 2018. It's called Giants, The Global Power Elite. It sounds like one that everyone should read. It documents who rules the world, who are these global elite, and how do they control just about everything. And he names names, so it's all right there. The research is done. All you have to do is get a copy and check it out. And to get a copy of this great new book, you can go to the website projectcensored.org. And again, that's projectcensored.org. For those who don't know, Peter Phillips is a former Project Censored director. He's a media monitoring sociologist and professor at Sonoma State University. The speech you're about to hear was given in March of 2018 at a conference as part of the Sonoma State University's fourth annual Social Justice Week, and it was partially sponsored by Project Censored. This video was recorded by Dennis Murphy of Petaluma Community Access and was lightly edited by me due to time constraints. So here he is, Peter Phillips, with the second and final part of that speech.
The post-9/11 wars continue to wreak havoc and death in the Middle East, Africa, and other regions. Over 180,000 people died in 46 conflicts in 2014. 65 million people are displaced refugees from 2017, fleeing war and famine. And these wars are not just the results of military adventurism or political conflicts, but are motivated by propagandized ideological fears of terrorism, the desire for profit and military investment. Lockheed Martin takes the lead with profit-making in war, with $36 billion spent in 2015. The perpetual war on terrorism is good for business, and the transnational capital investment people invest in these companies. So in the book I researched, and I found out that Lockheed Martin, if you look at the 17 giants, State Street has $15 billion invested in Lockheed Martin, Capital Group has $12 billion, Vanguard $6.5 billion, BlackRock $6 billion, Bank of America $3 billion, Bank of New York Mellon almost $1 billion, UBS $900 million, FMR Fidelity $700 million, Morgan Stanley $700 million. All of them are invested in Lockheed Martin. All of them are invested in Northrop Grumman, with State Street taking the lead at $5.9 billion. All of them are invested in Boeing, with Vanguard taking the lead at $11.9 billion. So these companies, these big war-making companies that make profit from war, are highly invested by the centralized capital giants. That's where it is. They also invest in Coca-Cola, by the way. And of course, Coke is the number one cause of diabetes and sugar consumption in the world, and they put out 1.4 billion plastic bottles a year, of which just a few percent of them are ever recycled, and they continue to do that. So the giants have no conscience in terms of where the money's invested. It's just wherever it can be the best returns. So if we think about part of this, is that the ultimate crisis of humanity, short of a global nuclear war, is also environmental degradation. Scholar David Ray Griffin asks in his book, Unprecedented, can civilization survive the CO2 crisis? Since pre-industrial times, the temperature has risen 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit, causing significant changes in our world's weather. Just 100 companies have been the source of 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since 1988. So the people causing this are a very small number, 100 companies. There's a 30-year lag between, it's a 10-year lag between CO2 emissions and temperature changes. So what we're putting out now, we'll see the impacts 10 years from now. The rising temperatures mean a continuing worsening of weather events, extreme storms, record-breaking heats, colds, fires, tidal surges, heavy death rates, and financial losses. We will see massive fresh water and food shortages. All of this will be in our future if left unchecked. Global capital is a primary contributor to those problems, and they invest in all the things that are making it happen. Actually, the financial money managers study the transforming environment for new investment opportunities. Climate change investing can be profitable, according to Forbes Investing. And getting in on low-carbon investments, and should climate change stress increase, investments in defense, health, property insurances are all good ideas, Forbes thinks. Increasing interest in new mining opportunities available due to global warming in Greenland and places where the ice is melting back. And private investment in the control of water sources is seen as an increasingly attractive opportunity for capital investment. The most important issue for the transnational capitalist class is protecting capital investment and building opportunities for future returns. If protecting the environment is profitable, then reinvestments are acceptable. What remains unacceptable is the spending of money on people, the environment, and services that do not benefit capitalism. This lack of concern for human betterment, intended or not, is the core contradiction of the transnational capitalist class and the true crisis of capitalism today. Our research focuses on transnational policy groups that are non-governmental. These organizations unite the transnational elites as a class The G30 and the Trilateral Commission are privately funded, staff-supported research organizations whereby TCC elites can speak openly on global capital and security issues, moving towards a consensus of understanding on needed policies and their implementations. These meetings offer the transnational elites opportunities to personally interact with each other in face-to-face, private, off-the-record settings that allow for personal intimacies, trust, and friendships to emerge. These interactions are the foundation of the transnational elite class consciousness and social awareness of their common interests. We think that the Group of 30, the G30 it's called, is a private nonprofit group based in Washington, and the Trilateral Commission, the two together having 86 elite members in their management teams, are essentially the central core of policy planning process for the world. Both are nonprofit corporations supported independently from government funding and any regulations that for them, they open up the discussion of global capital and security needs by people with common class and financial interests. 12 of our $17 trillion investment firms have one or more representatives on either the G30 or the Trilateral Commission or both. Goldman Sachs has four directors on the core of the Transnational Policy Group. The most important part of private policy planning organizations is that there's no government control or oversight. These are elites meeting together privately, often off the record. They will issue reports that are read very closely by the World Bank and NATO and others, but the G30 is one in particular. They describe themselves as they aim to deepen the understanding of international and economic financial issues and to explore the international repercussions of decisions taken in the public and private sectors. The G30 is a highly influential institution in the area of global finance. G30 was founded in 1978. Reports from study groups made up by the top bankers, financiers, policymakers, and academics. These reports are widely accepted and usually implemented around the globe. The G30 is a nonprofit corporation funded by Rockefeller Foundation and now receives close to $1 million a year in donated funds from various private sources. A G30 report in October 2016 on oil and global economy reports how the U.S. fracking technology has changed the industry, making the U.S. a global exporter of oil, resulting in lower prices and destabilization of the Middle East and North African countries, called those MENA countries. Middle East and North African countries. The report calls for the MENA countries to build more diversified competitive economies because we're selling oil cheaper and they're not doing so good. And the report calls for strong leadership because the regions need bold and creative governments will show the way for the youth and new entrepreneurs, encourage private initiative, and change attitudes from idleness and dependency to diligence and self-reliance. They said that right in the report. So in other words, if you're not a bold and creative government, upgrading your idle youth and complying with global capitalism's investment opportunities, you are likely to be replaced through an externally supported regime change. I mean, they just come out and they say this. The 32 of the G30 policy directors are deeply connected in the transnational institutions of central banks. 12 are from the U.S. One U.S. citizen has dual citizenship with Israel. 3 are French, 2 are from the UK, both from the House of Lords, 2 directors each from Germany and Mexico, including the former president of Mexico, 1 director each from Poland, Canada, Spain, Argentina, Italy, Brazil, Switzerland, Japan, India, Singapore, and China. Highly educated group, 16 of the 32 hold PhDs. 31 of them are men, and there's 1 woman, Gail Kelly, who's from the Australian Bankers Association. She also worked at the International Monetary Fund. She's the only woman in that group. Very, very powerful group. I mean, when they put out a policy plan, it's perceived by the World Bank as a direction to what to do. So Bank of International Settlement, their members are all linked into IMF, the Bank of International Settlements, the World Bank, the Basel Committee, Financial Stability Board, the G7, G20, WTO, and the Federal Reserve here in the U.S. These are very powerful people, and they all meet in one place. Privately put out reports, and we have zero input into what they're planning and thinking. All 32 members of the G30 have been keynote speakers at the World Economic Forum in Davos. Of the 17 most connected money management firms, There's six that are directly on the board of directors of those from the G30. So the G30 brings together 32 of the most powerful people in the world. They are essentially the executive committee of the policy core of global capitalism. They can formally develop policy recommendations outside of government oversight. They organize behind-the-scenes study groups with other TCC elites, and they provide an international understanding of policies needed to protect global capitalism and continued growth. They focus on security, and it's safe to say, the financial executive committee of the transnational capitalist class. One organization, very small. The other one that's far more international is the Trilateral Commission. This was founded in 1973, and it brings together unofficially, without government oversight again, the highest level group possible to address important international problems. Originally, the representatives were from Europe, U.S., and Japan only. In later years, representatives from around the world. It started in 73 with Rockefeller funding. Currently, there are 375 members from 40 countries, 87 from the U.S., Germany has 20, France, Italy, U.K. have 18 each. The Asian group has 100 members, and the remaining 124 from countries all over the world. Each country has a quota and can nominate people as openings become available. Members take formal positions in their government. They're asked to step down. So the formal members, if you're in government, you're not in the Trilateral Commission. Trilateral Commission is business executives, mostly men, but there's a good portion of women there, who are setting policy privately. They issue regular task force reports. The task force report in 2013-14 was entitled Engaging Russia, A Return to Containment. The authors were former U.S. Undersecretary, a Polish Prime Minister, and a former Japanese ambassador. The report was prepared in 2013. Multiple consultations were held in Mexico City, Manila, Krakow, Washington, D.C., and at Harvard. The report expressed concern that the Russian invasion of Crimea, and invasions is in quotes there, because the Russians didn't really invade Crimea. They already had bases there. And that was an agreement with the Ukraine government for a long time. Putin was described as bringing about a ruthless break with the West. Under Putin, Russia was not contributing to global stability, but rather aspires to be a superpower. U.S. business leaders are concerned about the anemic growth and economic climate in Russia. Concerns with Putin and the topic of his removal were clearly uppermost in the minds of the trilateralists. The TCC business elites are salivating over the opportunities Russia's vast economic resources offer for capitalist investment. Now, under Yeltsin, when the wall fell, and under Yeltsin, we did do a good bit of investment in Russia. We still have great investments there. But Putin has reasserted the government's control over the country. And so our capitalists are not as free to invest all over the world, and it requires government approval. So they're literally thinking and trying to put, you know, regime change in Russia as a primary agenda for what we're trying to do. That's why you've seen so much negative press in the U.S. corporate media about Putin and Russia. It's been constant. And the whole, they've interfered with our elections, and we did that to them a long time ago. But, you know, everything they've done, it's almost there daily in our media or on our television news. So that everybody's got this really negative, the Russians are bad, the Putin's bad, and it's been deliberate. The global corporate media are owned and controlled by the transnational capitalist class. Their primary goal is promotion of products and pro-capitalist propaganda through their psychological control of human desires, emotions, beliefs, fears, and values. That's what media does to us. Corporate media does this by manipulating our feelings and our cognition of human beings worldwide and promoting entertainment viewing as a distraction to global inequality. Corporate media receives two-thirds of their broadcast and print content from public relations and propaganda firms. It's not like all the news people are out there gathering news. They'll go cover the local wreck or what's happening at the jail. But when it comes to international policy issues, it's coming out of public relations firms, meaning that nearly all content for global capital media today is a prepackaged managed news, opinion, or entertainment. The big three global public relations firms are WPP, Omnicom, and Interpublic Group. I have a whole chapter on this. They get $35 billion a year in revenue, and they have total hegemony, and they promote the total hegemony of capitalism in the world today. There can be no alternatives. Public relations firms and their corporate media partners serve corporations, the government, and non-governmental organizations in an unrelenting ideological assault and the pacification of the minds of the masses of the world. To the people living on $2 a day, they're trying to convince them to smoke cigarettes and drink Coke. I mean, and it's American tobacco. The overall messages are the encouragement of the continued acquisition of material products and consumption, expanded desires for a life of luxury, fear of others, terrorists, criminals, threatening people, the support of police states, the acceptance of permanent war on terrorism, and the equation of private corporations as an essential element of democracy. This is what Noam Chomsky called engineering opinion and parading enemies. Now, an important world policy planning group is the Atlantic Council. The Atlantic Council is a nonprofit organization established in 1949 as an alliance from people in the countries of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. The stated goal was to build policies and institutions towards collective security and peace against the Russians, ideally. That was what it was about. And they have an annual budget of $20 million, and 74% of their funds come from contributions from private grants and private corporations. The Atlantic Council produces numerous policy reports, books, and papers. The U.S. NATO military security issues are a high priority for the Atlantic Council. This is another policy group that has 146 elite members in it that are setting the agendas for military action and security issues worldwide. And countries pay attention and follow them. These 146 elites come from 28 countries on the board of directors. Among the listed directors are four former NATO commanders, 13 representatives from major defense contractors, including Boeing, Raytheon, Bechtel, Lockheed Martin, BAE, SAIC, Carlyle Group, Booz Allen Hamilton. 11 directors are current or former military generals or admirals. 41 directors are active in government or private security, including the National Security Council and various public and private security policy groups, including cybersecurity. And also on this board is G4S. This is the international security company, the second largest employer in the world, with 650,000 people, but it's a private security people. Those are the ones with the dogs up in the Dakotas that were attacking the people trying to prevent the pipeline. So private mercenaries and private military companies are increasingly a part of war and manipulations in the world today. Global capital management and the protection of concentrated capital is a top priority for the Atlantic Council. 40 of the individuals on the board of directors were connected with capital investment management firms in some way. They were all very high in various large capital corporations. People on the board of directors, six were in the corporations of our 17 listed in our core group. They are the financial management investment firms from all over the world, and their job is to protect security for global capital. So we have, in the book I break it down, with the managers of global capital, that's 199 folks that are the board of directors of the 17 giants. Then we have the facilitators of capital. Those are the people on the Council of 30 and the Trilateral Commission who facilitate, make policies for capital's free flow and investment with no interference from governments anywhere in the world. And then we have the protectors of capital. That's the Atlantic Council and their use of the military intelligence, NATO, and the U.S. military empire worldwide to protect capital investment and its free flow. And when the U.S. NATO military empire is slow to perform or faces political resistance, that's when private security firms and private mercenary companies are increasingly filling the elite's demand for protection of their assets. These protection services included personal security for executives and their families, protection of safe residence and work zones, tactical military advisory and training of national police and armed services, intelligence gathering on democracy movements and opposition groups, weapons acquisitions and weapon systems management, and strike forces for military action and assassination. Private companies are doing that. We are privatizing war, and the capital elites are invested in that. Over $200 billion a year is spent on private security, employing some 15 million people. G4S is the second largest private employer with 625,000 people. They earned $10 billion a year in 2014. G4S works with Chrysler, Apple, Bank of America, Nigeria, The G4S counterinsurgency operations protect Chevron pipelines. They've undertaken similar operations in the South Sudan, provide surveillance for checkpoints. They help manage prisons in Israel and security for Jewish settlements in Palestine. G4S offers security guards, alarms, management, transportation systems, prison management, and electronic offenders in 120 countries around the world. So the U.S. NATO military empire is the police force for concentrated transnational capitalism with a few hundred individuals and the control tens of trillions of dollars. The core agenda for the global empire is protection of capital growth, the elimination of barriers and restrictions to the free movement of capital. The TCC shares an interest in ensuring capital growth and open opportunities for investment worldwide and is the driving force of capitalism. Global policymaking thereby becomes an important transnational function. The formation of transnational capitalist class, made up of persons with shared educational experiences, similar lifestyles, common ideologies, is rapidly becoming an essential component of global capitalism today. Institutions with capitalist countries, including government ministries, defense forces, intelligence agencies, the judiciary, universities, and representative bodies, all recognize to varying degrees that the overriding demands of transnational capital reach beyond the boundaries of nation states. The idea of legal boundaries for nation states has long been held sacrosanct in the traditional liberal capitalist economies. However, globalization has placed a new set of demands on capitalism that requires transnational mechanisms to support continued capital growth. Worldwide is increasingly beyond the boundaries of individual states. The financial crisis of 2008 is an acknowledgement of the global system of capital under threat. We see these demands as allowing for the abandonment of nation-state rights altogether by occupations, wars, trade agreements, and enforced economic rules. Failed states, manufactured civil wars, like in Syria, regime changes, direct invasions and occupations are all manifestations of the New World Order requirements for protecting transnational capital. The global power elites understand the need for transnational agreements and international mechanisms in support of capital expansion and growth. They are very rapidly building organizations to support transnational capital and bring together elites from every region of the world. Knowing who exactly they are as core players in the world is an important part of understanding about what needs to be done, which is the book we list 389 of them. And it's not too late for democracy movements to divert this onslaught of concentrated capital growth, but rapid adjustments are needed very soon if we value our human rights and democracy. Was that just too much to take in? It really is quite amazing. Most people don't realize the degree to which capital is so concentrated in the world today and how few people control it. That concentration is bigger than governments. Governments are paying attention to protecting the capital in a very big way. Yeah.
Here he was asked about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, known as the TPP.
I think we're still trying to move in that direction, but it's all about keeping capital, the free flow of capital, going and investments happening without trade barriers and that. So I'm still trying to figure out what Trump's doing with the steel industry, other than internal political stuff. But if he does too much of that, he's not going to be around very long. Because it's really Wall Street that's setting those up and making those plans. But what we're seeing, though, too, is in Davos they worry and they talk about the precariat. And the precariat is the working class people who aren't doing as well. And they're the ones that voted for BritEx in England. So they're standing up and revolting. So now we're trying to figure out how do we deal with middle class people voting. And in a way, that explains how Trump got in. Because he was not the choice of Wall Street particularly. He got through, but the best thing he did was get them the tax relief they wanted. So they saved billions and billions of dollars. Now I think they're starting to think rather seriously. And he put together an advisory board of 15 people originally, and they disbanded after some of the stuff he said last summer. So BlackRock board, Chase Manhattan, Jamie Dimon, they're certainly have second thoughts, but their idea is that, well, he's the one flying our airplane right now, so we have to support him. But I think if the airplane flies too far one way or the other and their impacts are happening, we'll see some kind of impeachment actions happen pretty quick.
Here he's responding to a question about the elite and transnational corporations.
Well, the elite are the people managing investment capital. Transnational corporations get a lot of money from those sources. So, you know, like Coca-Cola, I mean, massive amounts of money come from those investment management firms that go into Coca-Cola or American Tobacco or the auto dealerships. I mean, yeah, multinational companies, they need to have money. They need to have people invested. And increasingly, it's not you and me investing in them unless you're in a pension plan that does a little bit of that. And CalPERS invests in all of this stuff, too, which is my pension plan. But we don't have any say about it. And the impacts, the negative impacts that is happening environmentally and impacts in terms of increased wars and regime changes, it's just incredible. It's an awful manifestation. And the sooner we understand this and we can really relate to this and address it as the 99% and demand our democracy, that would empower us. And I think that social movements scare the hell out of them. I mean, we write a letter at the end of the book. 90 local folks have signed this letter. And we're saying, look, you guys, this isn't working well. The top 20% are getting wealthier, but the 80% aren't. And this will ultimately lead to civil wars, unrest, destruction, environmental riots, that sort of thing, and environmental collapse, and financial collapse with you guys, because you don't have places to invest all this money. So let's figure it out. Let's do something. Let's turn what you call a trickle-down into a river of resources that's going downward into the coffers of every human being on this world and pulling them out of poverty and adjusting. It wouldn't take that much. They are the ones in power to do that, short of massive civil wars and revolutions. And that gets pretty terrible. So, but they are capable. And we have to find the ones that support that kind of activity, encourage them, have social movements that really stress the inequality. And it doesn't matter what it is. I mean, social movements are happening around a lot of different things. But ideally, it would be an Occupy-type movement where people are in the streets in massive kinds of ways saying, we want the concentration of wealth stopped. We want billionaires stopped. We want to tax their money. You can be a millionaire. We'll let you stay wealthy. But we want all those resources put into humanitarian purposes for the world. And they could do it with public banks in every city. You could take the top 10% off of all of this growth investment and pretty much fund every family in the world to a level of human survival and humanitarian that meets the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We're going to have to tax or take it away from them in some capacity or force them to release that so that it goes to all human beings in the world. And this isn't just one country. We're talking global here. Thank you very much.
And that concludes the speech given in March of 2018 by Professor Peter Phillips on his new, soon-to-be-released book called Giants, the Global Power Elite. To get your copy, go to projectcensored.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. A delegation builds legal legislative support for Central American migrants and TPS holders with Iván Espinosa Madrigal, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice, who is also driving the landmark Centro Presente versus Trump lawsuit challenging the termination of TPS. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
So let's begin with the premise for the need for what you were trying to accomplish with the delegation you went to with, which was a high-profile delegation of federal and local elected officials and immigration advocates and legal experts who traveled to Honduras and El Salvador.
The need for this delegation is really multifaceted. I think there is significant misinformation out there about the conditions in these countries and why people are migrating from these countries to the United States, and ultimately whether immigrants from those countries can be sent back to Honduras and El Salvador safely. The government claims that people can be sent back in large numbers, and that is the premise of terminating critically important humanitarian programs like temporary protected status for nationals of those countries. And so going to Central America to visit countries affected by the cancellation of these humanitarian programs is important so that we could set the record straight and see with our own eyes what the conditions are. What are people living? What are people fleeing? And it's important for members of Congress, like Congressman McGovern, to see that as well, so that they can take that into account in policy making. So this was a very important trip to be able to really rebut myths about country conditions in Central America.
So if you could do that for us now, talk about the delegation's findings and raise awareness of the conditions driving the migration from the region.
I think in a nutshell, the most important takeaway is that migration to the United States has changed significantly over the last couple of decades. Yet most understandings of what is really triggering the immigrants to come to the United States hasn't changed. We still think about migrants and why they come here in a 1990s type of way as economic migrants, people who are just trying to be a part of the American dream. And that is not what's happening today. The bottom line is that people aren't coming here to be a part of the American dream. They are coming here because they're trying to escape the Honduras and the Salvadorian nightmare. It is deeply rooted in forced migration due to violence. And that is the driving force behind what we're seeing playing out at the border. This is why caravans are showing up at our southern border. This is why mothers with children are showing up at our border. What is triggering this migration is the violence, the instability. And by this violence and instability, I don't just mean gang violence. I also mean state violence, because it's almost a state of war. It's literally a state of war when in El Salvador and Honduras, the homicide rate is just as high as what you would experience in a war-ravaged country like Syria. You are just as likely to die in these Central American countries as you are to die from the civil war in Syria. And so we're talking about really dire conditions, and that's not a part of most American understandings of immigration.
When you say gang violence, and when you say state-sponsored violence, could you give a little bit more detail about that in both countries?
Yeah, of course. The bottom line is that with the surge in gang violence, most of the military and police interventions that have happened have been quite brutal in the scope and in the impact that is being felt on the ground. So for each gang-related activity that has been reported, for example, in San Salvador, we see a very, very strong state response. And that state response manifests itself often in killing indiscriminately gang members and bystanders in military and police interventions to quell gang activity. So there have been documented massacres that have taken place in low-income neighborhoods where there is a high incidence of gang activity. So police would come in to, quote-unquote, cleanse a neighborhood, cleanse the streets of gang activity, and in doing so, they just shoot up the place. And you are impacted by this type of violence and warlike conditions, regardless of whether you're a gang member, a gang affiliate, or a gang sympathizer. You could just be a random bystander who gets caught up in this wave, this very far-reaching net of violence. And so what we're seeing is not just gang members targeting civilians, for example, by extorting them and extorting businesses or trying to recruit teenagers to join the gang. Of course, that's happening on the ground, and that could be directly tied to private actors, to the gangs themselves. But we're then seeing the other side of the coin as well, which is the state apparatus using police and military to sweep the ground, and in so doing is really targeting not just the gang members, but people living in low-income communities where this gang activity tends to happen. And so there are documented massacres that have been taking place with no police accountability. And often these type of raids in these communities are being conducted with U.S. military and tactical training and support.
If we could get into that last part of what you suggested, to give us a better idea whether we're talking about, and if we're talking both about Honduras and whether we're talking about Honduras and El Salvador in that instance. What is provoking those gangs, and should we be creating that kind of bifurcation of violence versus economic deprivation, which is certainly related to the political structure and system, and in my belief should be a well-founded basis for people to immigrate here too when they're facing abject poverty, destitution, starvation. So can you parse that out for us a little bit more, the really the role of the U.S. and the intersectionality, really, of poverty in these countries and the growth of crime and violence?
You are absolutely right that there are families facing extreme poverty. We're talking about 56% of Honduras, for example, living with less than $1 a day. And nearly 80% of Honduras living in poverty. In El Salvador, the rates are a little better. They are not as economically deprived, but the numbers are still abysmal and quite frightening. And I think in this manner, and also in the gang-related activities, we see tremendous similarity between what happens in Honduras and what happens in El Salvador. The two countries are closely intertwined in these aspects, both in the depth of economic deprivation that is being felt on the ground, but also by similar patterns of gang activity, extreme militarization in response to that gang activity, and also tremendous corruption and impunity so that no one can be really held accountable. The institutions that we often take for granted in the United States, being able to go and file a police report, knowing that if you go to the police, you're not going to suffer repercussions for that. No one is going to come to your house and harm you because you want to report them. The police certainly won't take action against you in that way. And that once your complaint is filed, that it will be investigated. And that investigation will even involve potentially an independent prosecutor who will be in charge of addressing that. And you will be assigned a public defender. All of those legal mechanisms that in the United States we have in place, what I will call legal infrastructure, legal institutions, simply don't exist down there. There are no witness protection programs. People don't trust the police. People don't trust the government. And certainly, the government isn't generating either the security, the institutions, or the economic opportunities for its citizens. There are more people coming into the labor market every year in Honduras and El Salvador than the government can possibly, that the economy can possibly absorb in terms of jobs. So you're right that these issues of poverty are intertwined with a lot of the violence that we're seeing. But it's also important to note that under American and international law, the most important thing is whether you're fleeing violence as opposed to fleeing poverty. And that's an important distinction. If you show up at the border and you say that you're fleeing poverty, you do not have the same legal protections under asylum or refugee law than you would if you say, I am fleeing gang violence, or the police came into my community to cleanse it and it killed my relatives. And because I lived in that neighborhood, they are associating me with a gang, even though I'm not a gang member. And so now they're after me. Those cases are dealt in a different way under our asylum and refugee laws. And so you are right that there are intertwined aspects, but legally they are not dealt with in that intertwined manner. But one thing that is for sure is that the same dynamics that we see on the ground in Honduras are replicated in El Salvador and vice versa. And that's why in most understandings of this region, they call Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras the Northern Triangle of Central America, because they really do move forward together in these really tremendous deprivations of both economic opportunity and security.
So what I want to do now then, and we're speaking with Yvonne Espinosa Madrigal, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice. And as I said before, when we opened up, you are involved in what is a landmark case, Centro Presente versus Trump, the lawsuit challenging the termination of TPS status. So let me ask you this. How do your findings connect to buttressing the demand not to cancel the TPS status and keeping those refugees of violence, those migrants who have come here to save their lives virtually? How do your findings inform that litigation and the continuation of temporary protective status for people from Central America?
At the Lawyers Committee, we filed the first lawsuit at the national level, focusing on the cancellation of temporary protected status, TPS, for Honduras and El Salvador. There are hundreds of thousands of immigrants who have lived in the United States for well over two decades who are participating in these life-saving humanitarian programs. The programs have existed, like I said, for over two decades. They've existed under both Democratic and Republican administrations. So this isn't a blue or a red, a D or an R issue. These programs have been in place for a long time. And under the Trump administration, the programs are being dismantled. The Trump administration says that these programs are no longer needed, that these countries are not facing any type of humanitarian crisis, and that therefore they are capable of absorbing hundreds of thousands of people who would be sent back to this region. In our lawsuit, we are asking the federal court to invalidate the Trump administration's decision. We're basically asking the court to reverse the cancellation of the programs and to reinstate them. And a big part of what we're saying is not just that the Trump administration is biased against these immigrants. If you can recall, the Trump administration referred to immigrants from these countries as people coming from an expletive type of country. And those type of remarks really show the purpose and intent behind canceling the programs. These are undesirable immigrants. The Trump administration would rather have Norwegians here than have immigrants from these countries. And so we're making that argument in court. But also connected to that argument is that these countries simply cannot absorb these immigrants, and that our clients will be returned to countries that are not functioning, that cannot provide them with jobs or security, countries where they will be essentially facing a death sentence.
And in addition to that, how is the U.S. making it much harder for new refugees to get into this country, this zero-tolerance policy, and also the separation of children from families?
One of the things that we were able to do when we were in Central America is to meet with families affected by this separation crisis at the borders. We were able to meet with two families. One family hasn't seen their six-year-old boy for 3 months. That little boy has been held in a facility in Cayuga, New York, for 3 months, separated from his mother and father, who were deported immediately after coming into the country without their son. The six-year-old boy is desperate to be reunited with his family, and so is the family when we spoke to them in Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras. They are willing, ready, and able to take responsibility over their child. They thought that they were going to be reunited with the boy when they were being deported. That's what the government promised them. But that did not happen, and there is no date certain for their return. There is no agreement from the government that the kid will be returned. There is nothing, no word from the U.S. government, no word from the Honduran government. What we're talking about here is not just a crisis that happened and is over. There are 500 children approximately who are similarly situated, who remain in our detention facilities in the United States, but whose parents are no longer on U.S. soil because we have effectuated their removal. We need to reunify these kids with their families, and that is an urgent, urgent need. We also had an opportunity to speak to families who are talking about how the U.S. is providing military support and aid to train police officers, but doesn't hold those governments to U.S. standards to respect the rights of people. So we train them and we release them into the field, but there's no accountability about how they approach their jobs. And that lack of accountability, which leads to a lot of police brutality, leads to the massacres I discussed earlier, that is also connected to the United States and our policies. So it's not just what we're doing domestically by separating these families. It's also what we're doing internationally by providing tactical support and training, but not following up with the countries to make sure that there's accountability and that there is legal infrastructure and institutions to support these people.
And we're speaking again with Yvonne Espinosa Madrigal, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice. And one of the things that I'm interested in is the relief that you seek in the lawsuit that you have brought around TPS. And we are talking about people who have TPS status, and that is from Central America primarily, 250,000 people. And then, of course, there are Haitians who are similarly seeking and fighting against the expiration of TPS status, their TPS status. So the particular relief that you seek at this point, and I should say, I know that's on the legal level, but if there are also ideas that you have about legislative enactment towards the support of migrants, refugees who have been forced out of their countries by virtue of violence, by virtue of economic deprivation, and so on, very often from the policies that the U.S. supports of reactionary government structure.
Absolutely. To start with our lawsuit against the federal government to reinstate the temporary protected status program for Central American countries and Haiti. In that lawsuit, that's exactly what we're asking for. We're not asking for anything other than the continuation of a program that has existed for a long time. I think the federal government is really caught up on this idea that temporary protected status was supposed to be temporary. Well, the operative word was never temporary. It was protected. It is to keep people from being killed, keep people from being returned to countries that cannot readily provide for their safety and well-being. And we've lost touch of that. We've lost touch of the fact that these are humanitarian programs that are aligned with our American values. And that is really important. So in our case, we're asking for TPS to be reinstated. Give these people an opportunity to remain here until a correct and accurate account of what's happening in the home countries can be conducted and a plan really put into place. And like you're saying, there are policy dimensions here as well, because we deeply believe that you need to deploy multiple methodologies to secure the rights of vulnerable people and marginalized communities. And through multiple methodologies, I'm talking about not just our lawsuit to reinstate TPS, I'm also talking about legislation and policy. And that's where our congressional delegation to TPS countries in Central America really comes into play. We need legislation that will secure the rights of not just TPS recipients, but other people like the DACA dreamers, the children of immigrants who have been American for all intents and purposes, except that they were born in a different place and brought here when they were very young. So we need those proposals as well. And we would be really looking forward to seeing those proposals advance. I think ultimately, what we also need is to have a very sensible plan for how we move forward with immigration in this country. And I know that's a controversial issue, but we have to be able to compromise. We have to be able to get all of these factors aligned. What we want to do to maintain a steady flow of workers, not just for farms, but for factories and for high-level tech companies. We also need to be able to navigate the humanitarian responsibilities we have as a world leader. And we need to make sure that people who are already here, who do not pose a criminal or public safety threat, can be meaningfully incorporated into our society. All of these things need to happen. And so comprehensive immigration reform is long overdue, and we need to come up with a sensible plan that works for Democrats and Republicans, a bipartisan plan, and something that is a compromise. You know, neither side is going to get everything that they want, but that creates a sensible plan to move forward in a responsible manner.
And we're going to spend time, certainly in the weeks and months to come, to bring people like yourself back to discuss exactly what those recommendations would be and the various strategies for trumping the Trump administration's absolute reactionary responses to those people who have been the builders, the movers, the shakers, the heart, the soul of this country. And that is certainly the African labor that was brought here, the indigenous people, and the rest of the people. Who are they? They are the immigrants. This is a nation of immigrants, and it has benefited economically, politically, socially, and most decidedly culturally from the diversity of the people here who created the wealth of this country. We want to thank you so much for that report. Again, we have been speaking with Yvonne Espinosa Madrigal, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice. And you can go to their website and find out more about the landmark suit, Centro Presente versus Trump. And we'll continue to keep you posted as that suit winds its way for the courts. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
I'm hoping that years from now we can look back and say, isn't American democracy wonderful? We survived a despot.
Courts have no legitimate role, Justice Scalia would say, in creating new rights.
I haven't had any guys ask me out, but I have definitely had situations where there's been guys who I'm pretty sure they're flirting with me, and it's a really uncomfortable scenario.
I certainly am not comfortable flirting or talking to someone who I really don't know is gay, right? It's challenging in all sorts of ways.
I look feminine, and I assume that people will think that I'm straight, and I don't want that.
Yeah.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Germany's third gender pitch falls short. Trump resistance gains a warrior and a weapon, and tips for dating in high school while queer. Those stories and more this week, because you tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 18th, 2018. Germany is poised to become the first country in Europe to add a third gender option to government ID documents. The Federal Constitutional Court decided in a November 2017 ruling that not having that alternative violates individual rights and anti-bias laws, and that gender should be eliminated altogether unless another option was offered. The third gender proposal was okayed by the cabinet this week, but still awaits parliamentary approval. However, while it offers an alternative for intersex people who have had to declare no gender on government forms, it doesn't help transgender people at all. Marcus Ulrich of Germany's Lesbian and Gay Federation told Reuters that, for trans people, nothing has changed regarding the medical and legal obstacles they face to change their registered name and gender. And Richard Kohler of Transgender Europe said the new category would still require medical certification to prove that a person is intersex. Those who cannot or do not want to submit themselves to such invasive medicalization will remain excluded and without legal recognition, he said. Some queer rights groups still hailed the proposal as a step in the right direction.
The Trump administration has effectively rolled back yet another Obama-era policy favorable to LGBTQ people. An executive order issued by President Obama in 2014 banned anti-LGBT bias in the workplace by companies and nonprofits doing business with the federal government. One report said that the order covered some 34 million employees, about 22% of the U.S. workforce. While a directive issued this week by Trump's Labor Department doesn't directly revoke that order, it claims to incorporate recent developments in the law regarding religion-exercising organizations and individuals that essentially accomplishes the same thing. The directive cites the recent Supreme Court ruling in the case of Colorado cake baker and devout Christian Jack Phillips, who won a narrow victory upholding his right to refuse to make a wedding cake for a same-gender couple, and says that an employer's religious beliefs now trump the rights of their sexual and gender-variant employees. It was no surprise that Matt Staver of the far-right Liberty Council praised the action in a press release, saying that people of faith should not have to set aside their sincerely held religious beliefs to appease others. And Sharon McGowan of the queer advocacy group Lambda Legal told the Washington Blade that she was not surprised to see this administration seize on the Supreme Court decision as a way to justify its ongoing assault on the civil rights of the LGBT community.
Colorado baker Jack Phillips was himself back in the news this week, this time for refusing to make a cake for Autumn Scardina to celebrate her birthday after she told Phillips that it would coincidentally be celebrating her transition. After being rebuffed, the transgender Denver attorney filed a complaint with the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, who ruled in her favor, stating that bias based on sexual orientation and gender identity by businesses open to the public is clearly prohibited by state law. The commission reached the same conclusion about Phillips' refusal to make that same-gender couple's wedding cake. But the U.S. Supreme Court cited anti-religious bias by one of the commissioners to rule in Phillips' favor when the case reached them on appeal earlier this year. The high court ruling, nevertheless, expressed strong support for the state's right to establish laws that ban anti-LGBT discrimination. Attorneys for Phillips filed a lawsuit challenging the latest commission ruling against him in federal court on August 14th. For over 6 years now, the court filing asserts, Colorado has been on a crusade to crush plaintiff Jack Phillips because its officials despise what he believes and how he practices his faith. The baker is seeking restitution for legal fees and $100,000 in punitive damages.
Students returned to schools in the Oklahoma town of Ashley on August 15th after police shut down the campuses for 2 days following threats by parents to take a good sharp knife to a 12-year-old transgender student named Maddie. The threats popped up in a Facebook group for parents in the town of about 500 people after it became known that the seventh grader had used the girls' bathroom. Posts referred to Maddie as it, this thing, and a half-baked maggot. One suggested telling kids to just kick its ass in the bathroom and it won't want to come back. Maddie came out as transgender in the fifth grade and has been using the staff bathroom, but it was her first day in seventh grade at her new school, and she didn't know where it was, so when she had to go, she went to the nearest girls' bathroom. Several high-profile individuals and human rights groups have expressed their support for Maddie and her family, and an online fundraiser has exceeded the goal of $15,000. According to a Condé Nast report late this week, Maddie's mother, Brandy Rose, said she's using the money to move her family to the hopefully more hospitable city of Houston, Texas.
In other news, the manager of Abba's City Global Hotel in the southeastern Nigerian state of Abia phoned the police this week to report men kissing at the hotel bar and having sex with each other in one of the rooms. The local news outlet Punch called the manager's action a distress call. Six young men were paraded before local reporters and identified by name in a photo accompanying the Punch story. Each faces up to 14 years in prison under the Central African country's harsh laws against private, consensual, adult gay sex. According to the police report cited by Punch, the suspects were interrogated and it was discovered that they were members of a gang who came into Abia from nearby states to practice the unnatural act in the hotel room. One of the detainees, Ayanwan Chidera, said that they were all in one room because separate rooms at the hotel were not available. He said they were there to celebrate their friend's birthday and that there was nothing like kissing or making love in the room, and we are not gays. This is far from the first time that Nigerian authorities have trumpeted multiple arrests of gay people. 42 men at an HIV/AIDS education workshop were infamously arrested in the raid of a hotel conference room in Lagos last year and charged with committing homosexual acts.
Meanwhile, two South African girls have been expelled from school for kissing. Pink News reported that the teens were caught committing the offense at a private Christian boarding school for girls in Durban. The 8th and 9th graders denied the allegations, but the mother of one of the students said that the school's matron phoned to tell her to pick up her child and not bring her back. Officials at Inanda Seminary, which was founded by U.S. missionaries in 1869, said that one of the girl's mothers appealed, but that the verdict and sanction were upheld. Entrenched homophobia has yet to catch up with South Africa's progressive laws that are supposed to constitutionally protect LGBTQ people from discrimination.
And finally, updating a story we've been following for the past 6 years, a blatantly anti-queer Massachusetts minister tried to claim victory this week in a U.S. federal lawsuit brought against him by a leading Uganda queer rights group. Scott Lively wanted the First U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals to remove language in the lower court decision sharply condemning his homophobia. U.S. District Judge Michael A. Ponser reluctantly dismissed the lawsuit filed by Sexual Minorities Uganda, or SMUG, charging Lively with international human rights violations for spreading anti-queer hate during several trips to the East African country. According to Lively's book, The Pink Swastika, which he peddles wherever he goes, gay men ran Germany's Nazi party. He also claims that gays recruit through pedophilia and that butch gay men, embarrassed by their effeminate counterparts and not straight homophobic thugs, are responsible for the surge of anti-queer violence in Russia. While deciding that he had no jurisdiction in the case because it involved international law, Ponser took great pains in his ruling to condemn Lively's anti-queer positions as crackpot bigotry, ranging from the ludicrous to the abhorrent, and that there was no question that Lively aided and abetted efforts to demonize, intimidate, and injure LGBTI people in Uganda. Even though the appeals court refused to remove that language from Ponser's decision, it said it wasn't binding in future litigation between the parties. That's what Lively called his legal victory this week. But one of Smug's lawyers, Pamela C. Spees of the Center for Constitutional Rights, told The Advocate that they can spin it all they want, but Lively clearly wanted the language taken out. She also said they didn't expect the language in Ponsner's decision to be legally binding, and that her clients are considering filing a new lawsuit against Lively in Massachusetts state court.
That's News Wrap, Global Queer News with Attitude, for the week ending August 18, 2018. Written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazor, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. an informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the new and improved thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm John Dyer V.
A lot of people think I'm straight, and it caused all sorts of problems. How am I going to try to date someone of the same sex if any possible person of the same sex who might be interested in me thinks I'm straight?
Queer teens talk about coming out and going out in high school later in the program. Resistance to the anti-LGBTQ policies of the Trump administration saw the rise of a new warrior and the revelation of a potential weapon this week.
You know, tonight we made history. I am so proud to be the face of the Democrats tonight.
In Vermont, Christine Hallquist won the Democratic Party's primary vote for governor. If she defeats incumbent Republican Phil Scott, Hallquist will become the country's first transgender governor. She resigned as head of Vermont Electric Co-op to run on a platform including renewable energy, Medicare for all, and raising the minimum wage. As she told CNN's Don Lemon,
the fact that our president has gone after the transgender community is no surprise, and I think everybody should be afraid. You know, in the physics world, we say for every action, there's an opposite opposing reaction. Mm-hmm. What we're looking at in our political world is a definite reaction to what happened in 2016. People like myself, who are normally wouldn't be in politics, are rising up all over. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what a healthy democracy looks like. I'm hoping that years from now, we can look back and say, isn't American democracy wonderful? We survived a despot.
Hallquist will face off with a Republican opponent on November 6th in the pivotal U.S. midterm elections.
Here come the judge, here come the judge, order in the courtroom, here come the judge.
Advocates are working hard to expose the anti-LGBTQ biases demonstrated throughout the career of Trump's U.S. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Like the Democratic members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, activists have been blocked by the Republican majority from obtaining crucial records from Kavanaugh's tenure as staff secretary for President George W. Bush. There's no direct evidence from the nominee's own rulings about his stance on LGBTQ rights, but in a speech uncovered by MSNBC's The Rachel Maddow Show this week, Kavanaugh clearly affirmed rabidly homophobic Justice Antonin Scalia's opposition to the court inventing new rights not found in the Constitution, like reproductive freedom and marriage equality.
Courts have no legitimate role, Justice Scalia would say, in creating new rights not spelled out in the Constitution. On those issues, he believed in complete deference to the political branches in the states. Deference not for the sake of deference, but deference because the Constitution gave the court no legitimate role in the case. Think about his dissents in Casey on abortion and Obergefell on same-sex marriage, his opinions on the constitutionality of the death penalty in response to the abolitionist positions articulated by some of his fellow justices over the years. For Justice Scalia, it was not the court's job to improve on or update the Constitution to create new rights.
The Senate's Republican leadership intends to push through Kavanaugh's confirmation as Supreme Court Justice before the court's session begins in October.
I'm Roman Kalinin from Moscow. You are listening to This Way Out,
the showpiece of the homosexual movement in the United States.
Оставайтесь на нашей волне.
Stay on our wavelength.
I give him all my love, that's all I do. And if you saw my love, you
queer teens are rewriting the rules for dating in high school. They have to, because the progress of the LGBTQ movement in much of the world has brought them new complications along with new freedom. Last time, in the first of a two-part special feature, three members of Outcasting Overtime talked about some of their unique challenges. Here's the conclusion.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Alex, a youth participant in Outcasting's maiden studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcasters Andrea, Lauren, and I continue our conversation about the struggles of dating in high school as young queer people. For most teenagers and high schoolers, dating is pretty challenging. But for queer teens, it can be even more challenging. And often, we face challenges that straight people might not even imagine. Let's introduce ourselves. I'm Alex.
I'm Andrea.
I'm Lauren.
Earlier, we were talking about the specific differences between dating as a queer person and dating as a straight person.
We went on a few dates, although I don't think we really liked each other that much as anything other than friends, which made them kind of fun, but a little bit awkward. We were also getting a little bit of pressure from friends who believed that because we were two girls who also liked girls, you know, we have to be able to click. We have to be able to be in a relationship together.
Whenever I meet a new gay person, there is kind of this implicit pressure to try to make it work because the dating pool is so much smaller. Gossip and rumors are already so present in any high school experience, but it's kind of taken to a new level where you kind of need research. I certainly am not comfortable flirting or talking to someone who I really don't know is gay, right? It's challenging in all sorts of ways. So there's this kind of pressure to like find out beforehand. What makes dating for me so difficult is that a lot of people don't know I'm gay, which I find I'm a little incredulous about that. Yeah. I'm not sure how that's possible.
Me too. Yeah. We've established this.
But I find that a lot of people think I'm straight, and it caused all sorts of problems because there's that thing of, well, how am I going to try to date someone of the same sex if any possible person of the same sex who might be interested in me thinks I'm straight, right? Of course, the easy solution to that is to come out. But then again, I'm not sure that's a fulfilling way of coming out to people who I don't know very well. It's like, oh, just so I can kind of attract a future mate. Like, it's a little strange that we have to do that straight couples obviously don't. Mm-hmm. And another thing is that some girls have asked me out in the past, in recent memory, in very, very recent memory. It happens, I would say, frequently. I mean, I know because I'm so good looking and I'm so charming and I'm so fun to be around. But it happens decently frequently. And that is always a little concerning to me because I think it's very apparent that I'm gay. But I suppose maybe it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, like, I haven't had any guys ask me out, but I have definitely had situations where there's been guys who I'm pretty sure they're flirting with me, and it's a really uncomfortable scenario because it's like I also don't want to, like, overly assume, like, hey, stop flirting with me because that's kind of weird. But, like, it's also, like, you know, it's kind of a situation, kind of like you said, of, like, how do you not know? Because, like, I don't know, for me it seems pretty obvious, and also, like, that I'm out to a lot of people. It's sort of like, how do you reconcile this person's reality with yours where they're just so oblivious?
And also, because we are gay, I think we are pretty familiar with maybe some signs of someone being gay. Maybe, maybe some straight people who are not so used to having gay friends. Maybe they don't have any. Maybe all they've seen of gay people is, like, in the media and the news. We are not so stereotypical, I would say. We're pretty distinct individuals. We're all three of us are very distinct individuals. So
I can see that.
I think that everyone is unique and not stereotypical, but stereotypes aren't a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As a queer person, I would, if I had just met either of you, recognize you as being gay, or have at least. Yeah, no, I can see how a straight person might not see that because I've been around a very large and diverse groups of queer people. So I know that it's not always the stereotype that you see in a movie or a show.
And you know what? One of our fellow outcasters, who I've been friends with for a little while, he didn't know I was gay until a long time after even we started working on the show.
Yeah. It was the same thing with me, actually. I remember that.
Yeah. I think one of our other outcasters, one of our friends, like, told him, and he was totally shocked for some reason.
He had been friends with us for at least a year.
Oh, yeah. At least a year. At least a full school year.
Yeah. And I remember both of us being pretty shocked that he didn't know either of us were gay.
I think we were yelling at him a little bit.
A little bit. Yeah. Especially after being at Outcasting with us.
Yeah. It's interesting that a lot of gay people find the need to pass as straight. Mm-hmm. This is kind of the opposite.
Yeah.
Where we are trying, I'm not sure how actively we're trying this, but it is on our minds that maybe passing as straight is not a good thing.
Yeah. Especially kind of in the environment that we're in, you know, you were just saying like, oh, we're in New York, you know,
we're safe
less,
enough
like,
that we can.
Yeah. You know, generally it's not really an issue of like safety in terms of being
oh,
out.
Yeah.
There might be other social implications, but it's, you know, it's definitely safer and that allows us to lean a little bit more on the end of trying explicitly to be more out.
As kind of a feminine presenting person, I was trying to figure out why I didn't have that experience of someone not realizing that I was gay. And then I realized it's because I talk about it constantly, which is partially because I look feminine and I assume that people will think that I'm straight and I don't want that. I don't know. There's also like a gender kind of difference.
Yeah. And I suppose I don't talk about being gay very often. I'm not sure why I don't talk about it. It's just, it's not on my radar for things to talk about that frequently.
Yeah.
Usually I'm a very busy person. I'm usually busy with other things. Usually I'm moving around, getting things done. So it kind of falls to the back. But it probably shouldn't fall to the back because this is an important part of my being as a person. I am a queer person. I need to devote some time to this. I also really dislike coming out. It's really awkward. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've had a coming out experience that was not awkward.
Yeah. Especially because, you know, a lot of times it's like you were saying, like, it's not necessarily relevant in some senses.
Yeah.
You know, like, especially if it's not someone that you know that well, it's like, you know, why do I even need to tell you?
It's like, I can't just walk into someone like, oh, I'm a homo. Want to talk about that?
That would be so funny.
I've come out in stranger ways, I think.
I get that.
I'm the captain of my school's track team. And I was on a bus, and it was me and a close friend of mine who knows I'm gay. And we were sitting at the back of the bus, and we were talking to a bunch of our freshmen on the team, who we are pretty close with. They're nice. They're whatever, ABC. And the topic of, I think they were talking about pansexuality. And I kind of cleared it up for them because a lot of people misinterpret what pansexuality meant. I'm not pan. And they started to say, oh, Alex, are you part of the community? And I'm like, yeah. For starters, this girl who is very nice, I like her a lot. She's very nice, but she phrased it really strangely. She's like, oh, are you part of the community? I thought that was a little strange. I called her out on it. I'm like, what an awkward way to say that. Like how weird. And then I kind of told them my whole gist that I was gay. And then like one of them already knew. And I'm like, how did you know? And then he was like, oh, my sister told me. And I'm like, oh, she shouldn't have told you. But like, straight people don't have that scenario at all. I was kind of forced onto that scenario because they kind of directly asked me. I couldn't back out. Afterwards, the friend who I was with, who I'm very close with, she was talking to me. She's like, are you, like, okay? They kind of forced you to come out. I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. Like, and it was totally fine. I trust all of them. But it's definitely an awkward scenario, have to come out to a bunch of freshmen on the track team. And also, I'm going to have to do that to people who I'm interested in. Imagine how awkward that is. I mean, I've done that before.
Well, ideally, it wouldn't be awkward because if they're interested in you, that's something that they're probably waiting to hear.
Well, I'm not handling that many. I'm not juggling that much information. I don't know.
Yeah.
So even though our lives are fraught with more dating problems than a straight person might have, I feel like all three of us have substantially learned from these situations and we're able to help our other queer friends and also our straight friends.
Yeah.
And many queer people are people of support in communities and people who can be trusted, which is something that's maybe unique to us.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I've definitely found that, you know, a lot of times when you end up in LGBTQ sort of community areas, people are really helpful and friendly. And they get it, obviously, more so than most other people. So
some people who might be listening to this are probably young people around our age or maybe younger even or older who may or may not be queer. But if you are, then for those people, I want them to know that there might be some difficult experiences in dating if you are queer, but there are also some really great experiences. And you don't have to be with someone just because they're gay. You don't have to be with someone just because they like you. And you should have fun and be safe. Be safe, have fun.
Thanks so much, guys.
No problem.
It's been great.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Our assistant producer is Josh Valley, and our executive producer is Mark Sovis. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Tanya Kane Perry and John Dyer V, produced with Brian DeShazer, and from Outcasters Alex Lauren and Andrea, produced by Mark Sofus. The Magistrates and Benjamin Gibbard performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. Help keep our 30-year streak going at the redesigned thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on Quest of Life Radio, Portland, Oregon, KEUL, Girdwood and Hope, Alaska, 2BAY, Byron Bay, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you. studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Capitalism has some very basic requirements to tick over, and it needs them cut rate. According to Raj Patel and Jason W. Moore, they include cheap nature, energy, food, work, care, money, and lives. Yet these things are no longer as cheap as they once were. In the past, capitalism has been able to survive and even thrive from crises where key resources became scarce or expensive. But in A History of the World and Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet, Moore and Patel argue that that's not going to happen this time around. Moore, who joins me today, teaches world history and world ecology at Binghamton University and is coordinator of the World Ecology Research Network. His other books include Capitalism in the Web of Life. In the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I'm connected to PM Press, which has published Jason Moore. Jason, one of the key things that capitalism depends upon is nature, which you don't define as simply the external environment. So how do you define nature, and how has capitalism gotten nature on the cheap?
Well, for Raj and I think nature is the whole web of life, the totality of living beings and geographical and geological features on this planet and all the things that go into that. So that is a very broad idea that says, okay, humans are a part of nature. Now, that doesn't get us very far, but it does get us beyond the idea, the governing conceit of modern environmentalism, which says that humans do bad things to nature. And so it creates this idea of what is often called anthropogenic, made by humans, anthropogenic environmental change. In fact, this division of the world into humans in one category and nature in another hides the fact that racism and sexism and colonial power has always worked by seeking to relocate people into the realm of a different kind of nature, uppercase N nature. This is the nature that is outside society. And so if you've ever heard the expression, well, that's beyond the pale, it might be interesting to reflect that that language refers to the boundary line that the English invaders into Ireland in the 16th and 17th century established. It was a colonial line. And beyond the pale, beyond this line, which was just outside of what is today Dublin, were the savage. So the Irish were savage. They were outside of society. And that was happening in the 16th century at the same time as genocide in the Americas. The indigenous peoples were not human, not part of society, or not ready yet. And, oh, yes, the story that we tell in A History of the World and Seven Cheap Things is that their salvation would be to work for the conquerors, which invariably meant that they were worked to death. So there is a very violent history around the use and abuse of this word, nature, which is often taken for granted. And I think that as people who want social justice, a solution to the unfolding climate crisis, that we need to recognize nature as not just one of the most complicated words in the language, but also one of the most dangerous.
But you're arguing that cheap nature has been essential for capitalism. And a question that and then immediately jumps to mind is, are you saying that cheap nature was not important for other pre-capitalist societies that were based on class? Is this something particular to capitalism, something particular to class society?
Well, yes, it is very particular to capitalism. That's not to say that there weren't lots of ecological problems. You can go to the Sumerians, you can go to Song China, you can look at the Romans. Sure, there were lots of problems relating to deforestation, soil exhaustion and degradation. Lots of problems were set in motion. And yet there is a very sharp dividing line between those kinds of civilizations and capitalism. While human beings were long recognized as distinctive within the web of life, it is only in the centuries following the Columbian invasions of 1492 that we begin to see a civilization, capitalism, emerge on the basis of a very, very peculiar division, an either-or division. Either you are part of humanity and civilized society on the one hand, or you are part of nature on the other. And that is radically different from what we saw in medieval Europe. So when one can say, okay, well, you know, in feudal Europe, there was a terrible environmental transformations and deforestations, but it took centuries. With Columbus and with the emergence of capitalism, a very peculiar amalgam of political violence and the accumulation of wealth, we saw an entirely new strategy. That was to make nature separate, to move human beings, many human beings, into the realm of nature, and then to treat that zone as cheaply as possible. And that is at the heart of capitalism, even today. If you look at what is making capitalism go today, with the end of frontiers and the prospect of those frontiers not only stopping but imploding in an era of climate change, you see that there is more and more money floating around the world looking for some place to land, and there's not much productive to land in. There are empty Manhattan real estate, empty apartments in Manhattan. But beyond that, you are seeing a massive breakdown of how this system of cheap nature has worked for centuries. That is, the principal way of advancing profitability and cutting costs and accumulating wealth has been to reproduce and expand this zone of nature, is where work of all kinds, human work, but also the work of extra human natures, of animals and all the rest, and plants, can be put to work as cheaply as possible. And that's basically coming to an end today.
So just to be clear, when you use the term cheap, as in cheap nature, which you're arguing is now going away, partially under intense climate change, but not only, you are not just defining cheap as inexpensive. Is that correct?
Cheapness always in the modern world has two big meanings, and one is to treat as cheaply as possible in terms of price. So how do we get the silver from Peru in the 16th and 17th century into the big cities of Europe like Seville and Amsterdam? That's one dimension of the dynamic. But what we find, and this is what we explore in the book and what I've been elaborating in other work as well, is that there's a second meaning of cheapening. That is, to cheapen, to treat with less respect, to degrade the worth of a person, a human being's activities, but also of the work of nature as a whole. And so to the conceit of capitalism is to treat life, which cannot be reduced to a thing, as a set of cheap things. And that's crucial to remember, that when we talk about cheapness and how cheapness is coming to an end, we are talking about three different dimensions. One is, how does all of this massive wealth continue to accumulate in the hands of the 1% and continue to grow? And what are the limits to that? Another is, how practically are particular pieces of life, maybe food, maybe oil, maybe care work, reduced to the lowest possible price? And then finally, how is all of that wrapped up in an ethical and political and cultural politics of racism and sexism and colonialism? And if we leave that last moment out, we're in trouble. And so part of what this book tries to do is to put these moments together of the problem and dynamics of oppression and violence and state power with the fundamental questions of, how does capitalism work as a system of generating and accumulating wealth?
Before we move on to other cheaps, I want to ask you about a word that you used a few minutes ago, which is frontier. You said that frontiers are running out. What do you mean by frontiers, and why are they so important for capitalism?
So frontiers are at the heart of how capitalism works. That from the beginning, there's a reason why capitalism emerges through an unholy alliance of bankers, empires, and kind of invaders, warriors, that we see that the quest for valuable goods, potentially valuable goods outside of the system, but also potentially valuable labor that could be outside of the money system, but could be put to work to make goods and services, to make commodities within that money system more profitable. That's at the heart of how capitalism works. So if we take the longstanding feminist argument, which, as Sylvia Federici shows, goes all the way back to the 16th century, that if care work and domestic work were to be paid at its value, then capitalism would break down. To call to pay for the payment of wages for housework is to call for capitalism to pay its own costs of reproduction. And that's what it cannot do, because capitalism is an extraordinarily inefficient and costly system to run. So the whole history of the modern world from the era of Columbus onwards is about big capital and big empires locating sources of tremendous work outside of the system and finding ways to mobilize it for free or very low cost. Now, some of those have been about labor systems. So we saw this with African slavery for about four centuries. And we see this today with forms of coercive immigrant labor, with other forms of coerced work like prison work for extremely low wages. We see forms of that persist. But we also have the ongoing quest for, say, cheap energy. So the history of the Industrial Revolution is really fundamentally a history of one frontier that was under the ground, so taking up the work of life from billions of years ago and putting it to work for very free, but also the cheap work of soils and African slaves on the Mississippi Delta growing cotton that would ultimately make the Industrial Revolution go in a massive way in the 19th century. So we have to be aware that every major boom, economic expansion, great industrialization of the world, there has been some even greater movement to find new frontiers, new sources of wealth and energy and work and power outside of the market system, and then to find a way to put that to work as cheaply as possible. That's why capitalism is fundamentally about frontiers. Now, people always say, well, what about the oceans? What about the Arctic? What about Africa? All of these places are today pushed to the breaking point in extreme ways and have been thoroughly transformed. There will be more plastic in the oceans more plastic than fish in the oceans by 2050. That tells us something very important. But also, if you're paying attention to what's happening with climate change, a stable climate has been the fundamental condition for everything that has gone on for not just the past five centuries, but for the past 12,000 years, for this era called the Holocene, which actually means recent era.
Political economist and environmental historian Jason Moore is my guest. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, then, just following up with this notion that capitalism needs these frontiers, it needs to pull in these new elements in that it can get to produce very cheaply. But frequently, those new frontiers in the history of capitalism have been frontiers that have been opened up in a crisis. That is to say, capitalism stopped getting something cheaply, and then it figured out a way of innovating or leaping over that limit and getting something else. So a switch in energy inputs, for example. Tell us about that dynamic in all of this and why you think that is not operating now.
Well, your summary is spot on, Sasha, that the history of economic growth in the world and of economic crises is a history of not just scientific and technical innovation, but also of new imperialisms and new ways of expanding capitalism as a system of power over the whole surface of the planet, and indeed under the surface of the planet as well, as we know from the long and violent history of fossil fuel extraction. So what we have seen over the past four decades is the effort of states and big capital to find what few frontiers remained. So with oil and energy, we saw this scramble in the 1970s and 80s around opening up Alaska, the North Sea, the Gulf of West Africa, especially offshore production in West Africa. But these were all very, very modest efforts. We saw an effort to launch a new agricultural revolution on the basis of genetically modified crops. That has totally failed in the way along the model of what we've seen for the past four centuries. That is, it didn't give us a yield increase revolution. It didn't promise anything except to redistribute wealth and power from farmers to outfits like Monsanto. Now, there's that dimension, and we can quibble over how important the frontiers that remain are. We can clearly go to places like Amazonia and Borneo and elsewhere and see the expansion of cash crop agriculture. That is to be sure. But really, these pale in comparison with the opening of Africa in the 19th century, or the conquest of South Asia, or the conquest of the Americas in an earlier era. And if that were all, then I think we might have an argument on how well capitalism can survive. But, of course, there is climate change, which is accelerating and deepening faster and faster. And every new serious report that we have about climate change says this, that it is happening faster. It is more severe. This is not a 50-year problem. This is a 5- and 10-year problem. And if you happen to be living in a place like Puerto Rico or Cuba or South Florida, it is a right now massive problem. So what that means, why it's a problem, is that climate change, in the sense that we have been seeing it, does a whole series of things that makes the cost of business higher and higher. It devastates real estate, as we know. It makes the problem of cheap labor more difficult. It imposes all sorts of problems on modern cash crop agriculture, which, of course, is one of the central drivers of climate change. So it makes it even more difficult, in the face of the failure of the GMO revolution, to launch a new yield revolution, because as precipitation changes, as water runs out in various parts of the planet, as temperatures rise or the frosts fail to come in the way that they used to, then you have massive problems with growing food. And that is one of the reasons why, for example, we can have this conversation on the radio right now, because capitalism has emerged through producing surplus food on an unprecedented scale. That's now coming to an end, and there are many factors for that, but climate change is right at the heart of it. So that's an implosion of the frontiers. It's not just, oh, the frontiers have stopped and now we need to reorganize things. No, what we're seeing is the very beginning of a climate-induced explosion of the cost of doing business.
Well, let's talk about a number of the other things that had been cheap for capitalism and you're arguing are no longer cheap. One of them is money. Why is money so important to capitalism, and why is cheap money in danger?
Now, that is such a great question. This is something that came out of a lot of the discussions around my previous book, Capitalism in the Web of Life, and people kept saying, well, what about money? And indeed, credit is at the heart of capitalism and is at the heart of capitalism from the very beginning. It doesn't just become important with the rise of London or with the rise of New York City in the 20th century. It is there from the beginning. Indeed, Columbus's voyages, the voyages of invasion, were done on borrowed money. So we have to become very smart about how credit gets wrapped up with the violence of state power and the violence of empires, that states wage war on the basis of borrowed money. We live in one such state that is continuing to fight an endless war on the basis or on the presumption that cheap money will continue indefinitely. Of course, we know that's in trouble, because at some point, and we see this today, the solution, of course, to the last great crisis of 07-08 and the beginning of apparently a short-lived Great Recession was the solution was for the major states, the United States and other major central banks, to simply print a lot more money. That is not an eternal solution to the woes of capitalism. Indeed, the whole past 30 years, 35 years now, this era that we now call the neoliberal era from the 1970s, but beginning with a history of cheap money in the early 1980s, that the cost of borrowing money was very, very low. And that makes a lot of other problems go away. If you can continue to borrow money, there are a lot of problems that can be eased in the here and now. At some point, however, those debts are going to come due. And we're seeing that. We saw that the last financial crisis was sparked by subprime mortgages. And who knows where the next crisis will come from? Maybe it's student loans, which are unrepayable in this country for sure. Maybe from some other source, but very likely what we are going to live through is another financial crisis in which the major central banks of the world cannot simply print more money because nobody's going to want dollars, and I don't think anyone's going to want more euros.
Well, let's talk about work. Tell us why labor is so important to capitalism and how labor is no longer becoming cheap, because I think that might surprise a lot of listeners who see labor as incredibly cheap, especially in a country where unions are so weak.
Well, I think from any moral perspective, labor is, of course, way too cheap. The wages that people can earn in the United States, but of course all around the world, are atrociously low. And we have, of course, tens of millions of working poor in this country. It is an absolute travesty. Now, what we highlight are several key issues. One is that capitalism's claim to efficiency basically rests on a labor metric. So it asks how many hours, if you think of all the hours of paid work that go into making all the commodities in the world, we ask, well, how many hours does it take to produce a bushel of wheat or a car or a refrigerator? That's a very different way of organizing economic life in human history. If you went to France in the 12th century, the question wouldn't be how many bushels of rye could you grow in an average work year. It would be how many bushels could you produce on this acre of land. So that would be a land productivity metric. And a land productivity metric would mean very different things about the organization of life. So I mentioned the colossal inefficiency of capitalism. If we look at the energy inputs, at the land inputs, and all of that in something like agriculture. But if you look at just the labor productivity, it looks very good. All right, so there's a big sort of fundamental way in which capitalism values labor, but not all labor. It values paid labor, but then at the same time excludes all these other kinds of work, of care work, of the work of natures in all sorts of ways. And that's why we highlight this question of work at the center of the question of nature and the question of nature at the center of the question of work. So that speaks to a powerful problem in especially in American politics, but we see it in different forms all around the world. It's boiled down to jobs versus environment. You have a labor movement, you have an environmentalist movement. Environmentalist movements have done an absolutely wretched job in taking seriously the idea that work is central, that human work is central to the problems of environmental transformation. Meanwhile, labor movements have done an abysmal job in taking seriously the environment-making processes of capitalist work, and that if you are representing auto workers and you are not prepared to argue for a political strategy of climate justice, then that is going to cause colossal problems in terms of coming up with viable movements of climate justice that can pursue viable policies in the century ahead. So now your question, rightly so, is what do you mean cheap work? Don't we see isn't cheap work everywhere? How can you say that it's ending? And that requires that we understand, we have to step back a little bit from seeing the extraordinary poverty of low wages all around the world to look at what are the real flashpoints of work and industry in the world. And of course, if you look at a place like China, you see that not only is China the workshop of the world, it is also the place where you see rapid and frequent labor unrest, lots of strikes, militant workers, lots of organizing. And then there are a whole series of other pressures that are pushing up wages in a fairly significant and meaningful way. Now, these workers are still extraordinarily poor, don't get me wrong, but a doubling in the average labor share of income in China is massive, and that poses real problems to capitalists who are squeezed at every other point along the way. They're squeezed by finance capital, they're squeezed by competing with each other, they're squeezed by the specter of rising prices for the basic metals and energies and everything else they need to produce things. So there is a dynamic here where the cheap labor of the neoliberal era was produced by drawing in essentially hundreds of millions, billions of peasants from the countryside into labor markets in the cities. And that did indeed collapse wages. But we are seeing now, with the closure of the frontier, with escalating class conflict, with all sorts of other pressures, that the question of labor is no longer an easy question to deal with. And even the business press acknowledges this, that this is a big problem in China. Yeah, they can go to Cambodia, but Cambodia is small. It's not another China. So again, we have this process of labor frontiers, one after the other. And this is not an invention of the globalized world. This is an invention of the rise of capitalism, from the history of extracting Africans from the continent to work in the Americas, of extracting indigenous peoples to work in the mines in Peru. So there's a very long history to this, and it's not one that can go on forever.
But is there a danger of taking these moments of enormous expansion of capitalism, as you say, this tremendous transformation that has taken place as people who were peasants then entered the wage labor force? So that's a tremendous transformation and boon to the system, to the capitalist system. But if one takes that as the baseline and then sees everything that isn't as intense as that as kind of a system in decline, is that actually fair to do? I mean, aren't there moments in capitalism which are much more sluggish, but it doesn't mean necessarily the end of the system?
Well, that's right. That simply because economic growth is not as robust as it once was doesn't say anything in particular about crisis. So I think that it's always a danger to ring the bell and say the end is near, the end is near, the end is near. I think two things. One is that most of the people who have made that argument in the past have not done so on a basis of a historical analysis of capitalism as a whole over the past five centuries. And today that's possible to do, and that's been part of the project that I and others in the World Ecology Conversation have taken up, is how has capitalism dealt with its massive crisis? How has it resolved these crises and found a new way to resume and to revive economic growth? So we have to take that track record very seriously. And if we look at it, you have a decisive linkage between new forms of technology and new frontiers of cheap nature over the long run. So if you look at the original boom of capitalism in the 16th century, you see a very close connection between new map-making techniques, new cartographies, and new financial techniques and new shipbuilding techniques that allowed these tiny European powers to rule the oceans of the world by the end of the 17th, early 18th century. That was huge. If you look at the history of the Industrial Revolution, you have two great frontier technologies. One was the steam engine. The steam engine develops at the pit heads of mines to drain the water that accumulates at the bottom of the mines. So it is a classic frontier technology. It could only be used, the steam engine could only be used profitably because it used so much coal. It could only be used profitably right at the pit heads of mines itself. And then the other was the cotton gin, which tends to fade into the corners of our high school American history memory, but was arguably the most important technology of this period, which allowed for a new kind of cotton, short staple cotton, which could be easily be grown across the American South. It allowed for the profitable cultivation and export of that kind of cotton with African slave labor. So there again, those are two great examples of how arguably the way that most people think about the Industrial Revolution, it started with coal and steam. Well, that was a history of frontier making technologies. And again and again and again, at the end of the 19th century, when something that historians call the Second Industrial Revolution, with automobiles and petrochemicals and the electrical industry, that was also the era of what historians call the new imperialism of the European conquest of Africa and the scramble for Africa. And in the neoliberal era, we've had a very different form of imperialism, but one no less effective through the debt finance regime of the early 1980s that locked the rest of the global south, or much of the global south, into these onerous debt regimes that stopped their development and siphoned off wealth from the global south and into the coffers of the northern banks. So we have to ask, well, where are the frontiers today? And how does climate relate to all of those? And I think it would be much more of an argument if climate change was not ongoing. But climate change is. And the fact of the matter is that civilizations generally have a terrible time dealing with massive climate change. This was true for the Romans when their great period of good climate ended after the year 300. It was true for feudal Europe when the Little Ice Age comes in right around the year 1300. And it's And when capitalism faced the worst of the Little Ice Age in the 1600s, it had the whole planet to sort of bring in cheap energy, cheap food, cheap work. Today, capitalism doesn't have that. And oh, by the way, the climate change that we're dealing with now is an order of magnitude greater than those earlier episodes.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Jason W. Moore. He's co-author with Raj Patel of A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. That's published by UC Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He teaches in the sociology department at SUNY Binghamton and is the author of Capitalism in the Web of Life. So, Jason, it sounds like what you're saying is that while there are a number of cheap things that capitalism has depended on getting cheaply, that the most critical in many ways at this point is around cheap nature and cheap energy, that the climate component of the story has particular weight, because in the past, you know, there have been ebbs and flows in terms of cheap labor. Obviously, workers, whether they were slaves or wage workers, have in the past in history change their conditions through protests that have made their labor less cheap. So it seems that questions around nature and energy are especially important. And I guess it's obvious what cheap energy means. But can you tell us how it relates to labor? Because you're not seeing these things as discrete and separate from each other, but interacting.
Right. And cheap labor is so important because it makes labor more productive. We've seen this very clearly over the past 40 years, where every time the price of energy increases, labor productivity slows down. Now, is an energy transition possible? Yes, definitely. That's one part of it. Next, we need to ask, have we seen an energy transition in the history of capitalism? And the answer is an unequivocal no. There have been energy additions, but there's never been an energy transition. So
can you define what you mean by that, Jason?
Yes, absolutely. That capitalism emerges on the basis of an energy regime that draws overwhelmingly from wood made into charcoal and then peat, which is this kind of mossy vegetative matter that accumulates in wetlands and that is the youngest of the fossil fuels. And these were hugely important for much of northwestern Europe until really the end of the 18th century. But they didn't just go away. It's not like the world stopped burning charcoal for energy in the late 18th century. Indeed, the United States uses charcoal as its major energy source until the 1870s. Now, we know that the history of the modern world has also been shaped by fossil fuels. But we need to be careful when we point to a rock that is coal and say, oh, that's a fossil fuel. No, that's a rock. It is the relations of capitalism that turn it into a fossil fuel. So what happened is that the English, who happened to have a lot of coal, used coal in greater and greater and greater amounts across the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s. So that's another point. Don't think that coal was just put into use sometime in the 18th century. It was, in fact, there from the 16th century, and even the Romans called it the most important stone in Britain. So coal had been around and used for a very long time, but it was added into the mix. And then, of course, we had oil and natural gas coming online in a major way in the early 20th century. And so these energy sources have been added on. And as we know today, wood is still a major source of energy around the world. So is peat for hundreds of millions of people around the world. So it hasn't disappeared. And indeed, what we are seeing today with something like wind and solar, which is basically this. Yes, they are being added in to the extent that and new efficiencies are possible with solar and wind. Then that will make all mixes of energy relatively more desirable and more and cheaper, so that we have a situation in which the introduction of fossil fuel of alternative fuels rather makes the whole mix of energy production that much more possible. It's not really a transition. It's just adding on to an existing structure, and that's a terrible structure if our concern is to prevent Earth from becoming Venus.
Well, that being said, could we not conceive of, even if there continue to be these terrible other sources of energy, but when you're talking about frontiers, in terms of opening up new frontiers, would it not be possible to see a new sort of round of capitalist expansion and accumulation based on an unlimited resource, and that is the input of the sun?
Yeah, a solar transition is certainly technically possible. Now, there are several questions that are coming up. One is, who's going to fuel the investment around this? And if you look at the estimates of the International Energy Agency, they say it will take about $50 trillion to convert the world's energy infrastructure into something that is sustainable and renewable and climate friendly. It's not clear where that money is going to come from. Finance capital doesn't want to invest in it, and so that leaves the states. And it's not clear that there's the political will right now in any major state of the world to pursue the euthanasia of fossil fuel industries in favor of solar. That's one dimension of it. But even if somehow something that we could call capitalism would come up with the will to invest in an energy transition in that sense, which seems quite dubious to me, even if that were so, we would still have to deal with sharply rising concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. We would have to find a way to deal with climate change anyway, because a transition to solar does not decarbonize the atmosphere. It doesn't take the methane out of the atmosphere. So we have this double problem. It's not just a one dimension of the world needs to be fixed. Yes, maybe the energy transition could, it's certainly technically possible, but I think the argument, the burden of that argument has to be that there is the political will to affect that transition.
Indeed. And staying with that political question then, does that mean that we're doomed? Because if we're talking about politics, at this point, there's certainly not the political power from below to force a transformation, to get rid of capitalism and make sure that all of the steps that need to happen are taken to prevent climate disaster or to slow the climate disaster.
No, we're not doomed. I think that we have to be aware of capitalism's long history of fixing its crises and fixing its problems. And it's essentially a two-pronged strategy. It says we're going to go to new frontiers and use massive amounts of state power and violence to extract and produce cheap natures on a massive scale. That's one part of it. The other part is to extend the web of money relations, of what Marx called the cash nexus, to more dimensions of life. And these both have very powerful short to medium run effects that we tell in A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things. They are not eternal solutions. So those are the two big things that capital and empire today know how to do. Let's go to a new frontier. Well, that's certainly been part of the long-run endless war of the United States in places like the Middle East and Afghanistan. And then, of course, we've seen the past 40 years be an era of unrelenting privatization. So what happens when the major ways that capitalism goes about fixing its own problems are no longer available to it? We have to take that question very seriously. And we also have to take the historical experience of really profound climate change and the survival of civilization. So, Roman power in the West collapsed in the matter of about 150 years once the Roman climatic optimum ended and a new long period of relatively cool, wet weather came in the 5th and 6th centuries. The same thing for feudal Europe, which had been very dynamic. We use the expression, oh, it's medieval, to refer to something that's very backward. But in fact, medieval Europe was an extraordinarily dynamic place. And climate change simply opened the possibility for a new set of struggles around the organization of life and the distribution of wealth in feudal Europe. So climate change came into Europe in around 1300. And over the next century, you saw that peasants and workers organized in very powerful ways, very effective ways to say, first of all, we're not going back to that repressive feudalism you might imagine from your history textbooks of the serf working on the land for days and days, which had been essentially done away with in the 13th century. And the peasants and workers said, no, we're not going back to a more repressive system. We're not going to accept declines in our wages, and feudalism was done for in Western Europe. And that ushered in a long era of relative prosperity for working people in Western Europe. It was the same after the fall of Roman power in the 5th and 6th and 7th centuries, that it was a relative golden age for the peasantries of Western Europe. So what does that tell us? It tells us that empires are not very resilient in the face of climate change. And it tells us that once we once the power of the 1% goes away, that everyone else lives better. OK, so that's all well and good. But today's climate change is very different. It is, I think, easily an order of magnitude greater than what we've seen before. So even if you think that capitalism is resilient, which I don't think it is, I don't think there's evidence to believe that capitalism, which is now really in its old age and not doing all that well, and doesn't have its youthful vitality anymore because the frontiers are gone. Now what you're seeing is a double whammy of the end of the frontiers, the massive climate change, and, oh, yes, when that happens, people tend – even social movements that seem very weak begin to be able to make new connections and new alliances and to organize on a larger basis. And so there are, I think, serious grounds for hope, for an ecology of hope in the present.
Jason Moore is my guest. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain, and we're talking about his co-authored book with Raj Patel, A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things. So you are arguing that capitalism is in crisis, and unlike the crises of the past, that you don't think that capitalism will be able to survive this one. But what does that mean in political terms? I mean, you just said you thought there might be that there is a more basis for people to join up in opposition. But how do you think of the end of capitalism? Or is it something that we can imagine will just sort of fall apart in front of our eyes? Is it something that we have to do something about to make it go away? Can it just sort of stay in crisis indefinitely?
Well, no. I think that there are two real possibilities in the first, in the moment. One is that we can look at a certain tendency amongst the world's 1%, if you want, that one can take the most unequal elements of the neoliberal era. We can look at the most sort of security force-oriented, surveillance-oriented, gated community model of class society, and we could see very well a very fractured world, but a world in which the politics are in command of the production and accumulation of wealth. That would be very different from capitalism, in which, although it's often overstated, the market is the zone of accumulation and production and all of that. On the other hand, I think that we have seen tremendous possibilities and even imaginations for ideas and principles that would guide us in a post-capitalist world. And so I think we can look at movements like those around food justice and food sovereignty at their best, which say questions of climate and democracy and sustainability and food are all wrapped up with each other. It's not simply a matter of distributing more calories to everyone. This is a question of how food is itself an expressive and fundamental moment of the human experience with the rest of nature. And so it must contain principles of justice and equality and sustainability all at the same time. And I think that we're seeing similar calls in the climate justice movement, especially for new forms of collective consumption, say around transportation and healthcare and care work and the organization of agriculture as it relates to cities, that we could take as guiding threads moving forward. And we don't need to be romantic about this. I think we can look around the world, too, for some positive experiences that we can draw lessons from. We can look at what happened to Cuba after the end of cheap oil. And it was a very difficult time. The Cubans call it the special period, that agriculture had to be reinvented from the ground up and also had massive state support. And I'm not trying to romanticize this, but this was a period through which agriculture was reinvented. The average Cuban lost about 10 kilograms, but also the incidence of heart disease rapidly declined at the same time. And you have a situation where Havana grows more of its own food than any major city on Earth. Is it perfect? No. But it is an example of how, in a special period, we can draw on and cultivate solidarities to pursue a different way of relating to agriculture, of energy, and to each other.
Well, let me end by asking you something related to what you have just said. In the book with Raj Patel, you both call for a kind of broadening vision of thinking about life after capitalism and a challenge to people who have thought more narrowly about the environment as a compartmentalized thing with humans outside of it, and the labor movement thinking narrowly and in many ways with a sort of constrained ambitions. One of the things that has run through, let's just call it in a non-derogatory sense, through utopian thinking historically, has been the red thread of not just equality, but also abundance. Do you think that in thinking of life after capitalism now, that we need to be thinking about a world without that abundance? And if so, what are the implications of thinking about scarcity within our attempts to broaden our horizons about how life could be?
It's an amazing question. I think that the language of abundance and scarcity is difficult even to imagine because we have been so disciplined by capitalist culture that we are taught that abundance is 100 varieties of breakfast cereal in the grocery store. We're taught that scarcity is something to be feared and almost terrorized by, and that would be, I suppose, the inverse. It would be people waiting in bread lines, the old anti-communist imaginary you have to wait for hours to get your bread or something like that. Of course, there have been plenty of moments in the history of capitalism where people had to wait in line to get bread and where it was scarce and not available because scarcity is determined by the money form. So I think this question of abundance is fundamental. I worry about, at the same time as I'm inspired in some ways, I also worry about certain versions of the abundant utopian argument on the left that suggests that it's all about or principally about something like automation. And I think while there are important kernels of truth in that argument, we also have to see abundance in terms of our relationship with all life and an abundance of care, an abundance of love, an abundance of solidarity with each other, but also with all forms of life on this planet. And much of that, I know, resembles a kind of older environmentalist imaginary. I think where I would say it's different is that we need an abundance of rewarding work. Without being romantic about that, we need to have a vision that sees work as part of it, that it's not that abundance and a communist utopia is not a freedom from work. It is for different relationships of life and work and play that we have to take seriously as we move forward. So I think that would be one point of departure for a kind of utopian thinking that would be grounded in the concrete experiences and struggles of today.
Jason Moore, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sasha. As ever, brilliant to be here.
I've been speaking with the co-author with Raj Patel of A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. That's published by UC Press. Jason Moore is also the author of Capitalism in the Web of Life, Ecology and the Accumulation of Capital, and he teaches in the sociology department at SUNY Binghamton. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.